Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Polluted water in Flint, Michigan, Puerto Rico's slow recovery from Hurricane Maria. These are just a couple of examples of the ways that mostly poor people of color often suffer disproportionate harm from environmental crises. But how does the environment shape intelligence and IQ? A new book by Harriet Washington looks at this issue. It's called A Terrible Thing to Waste: Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. In it, Washington argues that IQ, while a flawed metric, is a useful tool to gauge cognitive damage brought on by environmental hazards. When we sat down with her, she said the negative effects of environmental racism can be seen in a town she writes about called Anniston, Alabama.
They had been the victims of several industries and the U.S. government that had various types of noxious chemicals that were used in industry. And when the industry polluted the area, they did not inform the people, you know, that their water, for example, was rife with PCBs. And so people were poisoned steadily over the course of decades without knowing why. Children were dying of diseases that we tend to ascribe to adults, you know, heart disease, kidney disease, a lot of cancers, et cetera. And finally, when it was found that these people were dying from diseases that were caused by chemical companies, some of the chemical companies basically pulled out of the area. There were several lawsuits, but Johnny Cochran's lawsuit did indeed get a huge settlement for them and established a health center so they could finally have these ailments addressed. But the money did not last very long. The health center had to close just a few years ago. And now these people have spent their lives there. They're living basically in a poisoned environment. I thought of it as a science fiction environment. You know, people are growing their plants that used to be in their gardens in big plastic drums because the soil is poisoned. So it's a very, very post-apocalyptic landscape. And these people who are almost completely black people don't now have very little recourse. And it's something that's happening all across our country.
And you document multiple communities that have been touched by environmental racism. And in each case, or in many cases, it's a different pollutant in different communities, but the effects are similar. Why are people of color, this is a simple question, but I want to ask it, why are people of color disproportionately affected by this?
For the same reasons they're disproportionately affected by many things. It's various racist policies that have persisted for decades, and in some cases centuries, have herded them into areas where they are exposed to toxins. Segregation is a factor in many urban areas. In Baltimore, black people live in certain parts of the city because they can't go elsewhere. When lead was found to be devastatingly harmful, and it was harmful to everybody, white and black people, when that was found to be the case, whites were able to go to the suburbs to housing that had never been exposed to lead and live away from the hazards. But black people were not allowed to move into suburbs. They weren't allowed to move into white communities at all. They were trapped in these areas where they tended not to have ownership of their homes because of redlining and other racial policies. So they did not have the force that a homeowner might have in terms of forcing some kind of government action. So a lot of racial policies conspire to create communities that are relatively powerless and have been concentrated in areas that are harmful.
So you went into your research, of course, knowing that there were some disparities, and I gather wanting to unpack them a bit more. But what was the most surprising thing you discovered in doing this work?
I was most impressed by the fact that one argument that industry and the chemists and scientists that it employs to defend itself, one of their arguments is that very often we're talking about very small exposures. For example, they'll point out that you're so worried about this exposure to PCBs here, but we're talking about one drop in 118 bathtubs full. Clearly, that's not a problem. Sometimes it is a problem. You know, scientists have sometimes made assumptions about thresholds when thresholds don't exist, or assuming that there has to be a certain level of exposure to create harm.
Overestimating the amount of exposure
exactly.
That could be harmful.
Yes. So the thing is that for fetuses and very young children, one drop in 118 bathtubs full can indeed be harmful. They have this exquisite vulnerability caused by the fact that their brains are still forming and there are developmental windows. For example, axons migrate on a certain day. A certain brain structure is formed on a certain day or a certain week. If they're exposed to a tiny, tiny bit of chemical any other day, it might have no effect at all. But if they're exposed on the date when that particular structure is being built, it can be a devastatingly harmful effect. So that surprised me how commonly it is that very low doses can be extremely harmful to the developing fetus. I knew it happened. I didn't know it happened so often.
But you say there is a glimmer of hope in that if we do collectively work together, some of these problems can be fixed. What are some of the most important changes you would like to see in terms of public policy?
We have to stop the rollback of EPA policies. Under the Obama administration and earlier administrations, we were starting to make real progress. When the current administration took office, there were only 4 chloralkali plants left. The others had been closed. These spew a great deal of mercury into the atmosphere. They were slated to close, but the EPA under Trump decided not to close these plants. A few days ago, the EPA under Trump decided to stop surprise inspections, which is going to, of course, diminish their effectiveness. So we're rolling back the progress that we had made. Then we have to reevaluate the way we test chemicals. In the European Union, you have to test a chemical that's going to be used in or near humans for its effect on human health before you can market it. In this country, we market the chemicals and only begin testing after complaints that people have been harmed. And one of the things corporations tend to say is that it's so expensive to do these tests. There are things more important than money. Right now, 23 million IQ points are lost every year in children from exposure to lead. And how do you put a price on that?
That's Harriet Washington, author of the new book, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, January 9, 2020. So I have been told. Reading is more important than watching television, and a major point of contention on our broadcast just 24 hours ago with Professor Andrea Freeman down in Hawaii, 2-hour time difference, was whether or not white people deliberately encouraging black females to use synthetic formula as opposed to breastfeeding when it is almost unanimously agreed upon by scientists that breastfeeding is best. Is this chemical and biological warfare? Professor Freeman had to think about it. She wasn't sure. She was unequivocal, even after writing this book. Skimmed. To follow that with our debut session on A Terrible Thing to Waste. Harriet A. Washington should be familiar to Cal's listeners. I have raved about medical apartheid for a long time. We read it in the book club way back in 2016 in my top 5. I think just an extraordinarily important book, and just in terms of detailing the long history of medical terrorism, even relating to what we talked to yesterday. I mentioned it repeatedly during the broadcast with Professor Freeman, Medical Apartheid, Chemical and Biological Warfare Against Black People in a Variety of Forms. Again, our book for today, the second time around, it's very rare that we have an author in the book club where we repeat, we come back and read something else that they wrote. I think the late Toni Morrison is one exception to the rule, but it's very rare. I am excited to read this book because we have not done enough work on environmental racism here at the COWS. We need to do more, and this is at least a small effort in that direction. I so thoroughly enjoyed reading Medical Apartheid. I thought it was so informative and painful to listen to at times, but just crucial information, documentation, the historical record of white tyranny in their white lab coats. But just following up, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. Making me think of Dr. Welsing and the Brain Computer. We will go ahead and get started. This is The COWS. Audio segment number one from the great Harriet A. Washington.
This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. Written by Harriet A. Washington. Read by Ron Butler. Introduction. IQ Matters. Nature has color-coded groups of individuals so that statistically reliable predictions of their adaptability to intellectually rewarding and effective lives can easily be made. William Shockley, Models, Mathematics, and the Moral Obligation to Diagnose the Origin of Negro IQ Deficits, Review of Educational Research. Long before William Shockley's 1971 assertion that the intelligence of Americans is innate, inherited, and permanently stratified by race, the 19th century scientists known as the American School of Ethnology had trumpeted the same belief, sans statistics. Their assertions were preceded by a long, data-free history of speculation by Europeans on the lower intelligence of Africans and their descendants, speculation that had traditionally supplied a rationale for enslavement. The question of whether innate differences in intelligence exist between blacks and whites goes back more than 1,000 years. To the time when the Moors invaded Europe. Although we focus on European claims that Africans and their descendants are relatively unintelligent, some people of the African diaspora, including the scientifically adept and accomplished Moors, have returned the favor. As Richard E. Nisbet, author of Intelligence and How to Get It, Why Schools and Cultures Count, writes, the Moors speculated that Europeans might be congenitally incapable of abstract thought. But no Moors practiced science in the United States, and in 1840, the government falsified census data to support enslavement with the spurious claim that slaves enjoyed much better mental health than freedmen. Thereafter, freedom was held to be detrimental to African Americans' mental health. In 1981, Stephen Jay Gould's The Mismeasure of Man documented the long history of painstaking but rigged data collection and analysis enlisted to support the cherished belief in the innate intellectual inferiority of blacks. So, too, have Even the Rat Was White, first published in 1976 by the late psychologist Robert V. Guthrie, as well as a slew of more recent works. Today, the hereditarian agenda still drives fevered debate about intelligence, or to be more precise, about IQ. Accusations of racism and political correctness fly in reaction to each provocative new publication on race and IQ. The headlines, and too much of the scientific discourse, dwell on the 15-point gap between the average scores of U.S. whites and African Americans. Much hand-wringing ensues. What can be done? Are interventions futile? In the end, This very public and very political drama drives a false perception of genetics as the chief factor determining IQ. And the sniping between hereditarians and their critics has accomplished nothing except a great deal of harping on the prohibitive expense and futility of intervening to close the gap. After all, hereditarians argue, nothing can be done to correct the innate, genetically dictated, lower IQ status of African Americans. In tones of infinite regret, their screeds and interviews insist that devoting resources to closing it would be a quixotic and irresponsibly expensive task. The racial IQ gap is impervious to treatment and here to stay. This bleak prospect is not supported by the facts. Salt of the Earth. Consider that in 1924, the United States closed another 15-point IQ gap with a single, cheap step. We added iodine to salt. The government didn't set out to increase IQ. That was a happy accident. The consequence of a program intended to address nutritional deficiency diseases, chiefly goiters, that are caused by insufficient iodine in the diet. Before 1920, whether or not your diet contained sufficient iodine depended largely on where your water came from. Seawater, for instance, is rich in iodine, which is fortunate for countries like Japan, which has some of the world's most iodine-rich water and boasts one of the world's highest average IQs. But in a place like Michigan, where the natural water supply was largely runoff from iodine-free glaciers, much of the water and soil in which vegetables grew lacked iodine. This deficiency heightened the rates of goiter, an enlarged thyroid that causes an unsightly lump in the neck. Goiters are rarely life-threatening, but some require medication or surgery. For just a few dollars a ton, adding iodine to salt, in the form of potassium iodide, greatly lowered the incidence of deficiency and goiters. But during World War II, when a new crop of Air Force recruits was tested with the Army General Classification Test, scientists noticed a pattern. Men from low iodine areas who showed improved thyroid health also scored substantially higher on the intelligence test. It turns out that iodine deficiency is an unrecognized cause of mental retardation, especially, but not exclusively, in unborn children. Now we know that iodine bolsters healthy brain development because it is an essential component of thyroid hormone, which helps to direct the complex development of the fetal brain. Yet iodine deficiency remains the world's leading cause of preventable mental retardation. Prenatal iodine deficiency, as well as deficiency in adulthood, leads to compromised intelligence as measured by IQ testing, especially in the developing nations that report some of the world's lowest IQ scores. In 2007, Kul Gautam, the deputy executive director of UNICEF, announced, "Today, over 1 billion people in the world suffer from iodine deficiency, and 38 million babies born every year are not protected from brain damage due to IDD. Almost one-third of the world's population has too little iodine in its diet. And the problem isn't limited to developing countries. In Europe, iodized salt is still not the norm. Moreover, the health-conscious trend toward reducing salt intake has lowered iodine intake as well. So has the gourmet penchant for natural sea salt, which does not contain iodine. Within the United States, African Americans suffer the nation's highest level of iodine deficiency. According to the government's National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, NHANES, data for 2005 to 2008, African Americans' urinary iodine reading of 137 micrograms per liter is lower than that of Mexican Americans at 174 micrograms per liter and of non-Hispanic whites at 168 micrograms per liter. No separate data are given for Native Americans or other ethnic groups. Today, nearly a century after iodine's effects on the brain were first discovered, a wealth of contemporary studies warns of many other environmental factors that, like iodine, dramatically affect intelligence and IQ. These range from lead, which recently made national headlines for contaminating the drinking water in Flint, Michigan, to other poisonous metals such as arsenic and mercury, which often accompany lead and commonly poison reservation lands. Unsurprisingly, the deleterious effects of chemicals in the environment have been most widely reported when they impact white, relatively affluent communities. In the 1980s, for instance, headlines frequently updated us on the struggles of communities like Love Canal in Niagara Falls, New York, where a 70-acre landfill spewed pollution that threatened the health of hundreds. But we never read about Anniston. Saving Anniston. I first heard about Anniston, Alabama, during a chance encounter in the heart of New York City. In 2005, I spent most weekdays at the New York Public Library's iconic Stephen A. Schwarzman building at the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue. One March day, I had tired of writing and emerged from the library around 3 o'clock, in plenty of time to beat the rush hour traffic back to my home in Spanish Harlem. As I joined the queue for the bus, I stole a peek at my BlackBerry, where sad news awaited. Johnny Cochran had died. Almost immediately, a 70-ish African-American man joined the line behind me. He was thin, looked a bit frail, and wore an immaculate but slightly faded trench coat, a black fedora, and an expression of care and pain. As the bus arrived, he slowly mounted the steps behind me, sighing lightly. As I twisted around to make sure he was all right, he looked up and asked, "You heard about Johnny Cochran?" "Yes," I said as gently as I could. "It's a great loss." The man shook his head sadly and continued his ascent. Another man murmured something to him, and though I didn't catch the words, I understood the tone. This sadness was felt by many people, some of whom didn't care a fig about the exoneration Cochran had won for O.J. Simpson in 1995. African-American men are so often demonized that it is hard to realize the extent to which they bear the brunt of bias in the workplace and in the health and justice systems, with few protectors. For many, Cochran had been a powerful legal champion who symbolized the possibility of long-delayed justice. But now he was gone. As we took our seats, the man in the trench coat spoke again, more audibly, with an air of satisfaction. "You know, I'm from Anniston, Alabama. They thought they could poison our homes and children, but Johnny Cochran made them stop. He made them stop, and he made them pay." The other nodded glumly. Then they fell again into silence. I'd all but forgotten his words when I heard the name again, this time at Cochran's funeral. In his eulogy, trial lawyer Theodore V. Wells capped a list of Cochran's triumphs for the downtrodden with, "And today they've got that health center down in Anniston because of Johnny Cochran." I had to know more, and a little research quickly revealed that right after securing O.J. Simpson's not guilty verdict, Cochran had been approached by Anniston activist David Baker, executive director of the activist group Community Against Pollution in Anniston. Baker had explained that sickness was rampant among Anniston's inhabitants, thanks to extensive pollution caused by the Monsanto Company, the Olin Corporation, and even the U.S. Army. Even so, the Environmental Protection Agency and the Justice Department had utterly failed to pursue the offenders, leaving the citizens of Anniston, including children, to suffer with brain damage, lower intelligence, and behavioral problems. Cochran agreed to help them obtain compensation for their losses. He kept his word, organized a class action suit, and procured for the victims the largest settlement ever won in the United States, including $50 million for a health clinic to address their rampant cancer, liver disease, and cognition problems such as memory loss. As I read transcripts related to the suit, I was struck by Cochran's exclamation, "There is always some study, and they'll study it to death. Then 30 years later, you find out it's bad for you. We know it's bad for us right now." In language that everyone can understand, Cochrane was expressing an important precept that we have long shunned in the United States, called the precautionary principle. Poisoned mines. Approximately 60,000 industrial chemicals commonly used in the United States have never been tested for their effects on humans. In our country, safety tests are undertaken only when a chemical is suspected to be harmful. But even then, definitive findings are elusive, and it sometimes takes years or even decades of expensive research for them to emerge. Meanwhile, the standard of proof demanded by the industries that use and disseminate these chemicals is sometimes so high that masses of people suffer their effects in the time it takes to sufficiently prove their harmfulness. In the case of lead alone, the Environmental Defense Fund has noted that thousands of children were poisoned at a cost of $50 billion to the nation while we awaited sufficient proof to take action. As Cochrane suggested, there is a better way. The European Union, for instance, requires human safety tests before any new industrial chemical is unleashed into the ground, atmosphere, and neighboring communities. It subscribes to the precautionary principle. In plain English, it is better safe than sorry. Because we have ignored this precept, lead poisoning has cost our country a staggering $50 billion. But it has also cost our nation something far more precious: 23 million lost IQ points every year. And this frightful cost is the subject of this book, which discusses a specific, devastating, and all but unregarded injury that environmental poisoning inflicts on communities of color: the loss of intelligence and the malignant flowering of behavioral problems that destroy lives and human potential as effectively as cancer and lung disease, but with far fewer alarms raised. IQ tests measure this loss of cognition, imperfectly, to be sure, but in a useful manner. The catalog of industrial chemicals known to erode intelligence is extraordinarily long, and many others are suspected of changing how well we think. In the chapters of this book, I reveal them. I delve into the deleterious effects of exposure to the witch's brew of chemicals, including PCBs, BPA, phthalates, volatile hydrocarbons, and more, that afflict adults, children, and the unborn within the nation's communities of color. I will discuss the cognitive costs of brain-hobbling microbes and, of course, exposure to heavy metals such as mercury and lead, which is blighting lives in the ongoing Flint water crisis. Other common intelligence-lowering exposures include DDT and other pesticides that poison the soil, fish, and gardens of Triana, Alabama. The arsenic that turned neighboring Anniston into a post-apocalyptic wasteland. The radioactivity spilling from Nana Azteon uranium mines in New Mexico. The PCBs of Afton, North Carolina. And even the air pollution of Spanish Harlem. These are just a few of the 200 types of chemical exposure that have been shown to reduce intelligence and brain function by the work of scientists such as Philip Landrigan, Bruce Lamphere, and Philippe Grandjean, who dubs such intelligence-eroding chemicals brain drainers. Medical journals offer evidence that many of the 140,000 untested industrial chemicals in worldwide use impede intelligence. As we will see, these chemicals are far more likely to find their way into African American, Hispanic, and Native American communities, affecting their water, land, and even schools, than into white communities. Fence-line communities that abut toxin-belching industries, secret or open toxic dump sites, Superfund waste sites, and emission-belching diesel plants are preferentially located in communities of color, both poor and middle class. Robert Bullard, founder of the EPA Office of Environmental Equity, points out that the Moton School in New Orleans, for example, is built on top of a landfill, which leaches dangerous chemicals into the school's water supply. And similar hazards are rife in the nation's other ethnic communities. In South Camden, New Jersey, Schools and playgrounds are located on the waterfront alongside heavy industries of many kinds. Almost two-thirds of the children in that neighborhood have asthma. In West Harlem, the North River Water Treatment Plant covers 8 blocks near a school. On the south side of Chicago, it's the same kind of thing. The very young brain is not just that of a miniature adult. Fetal and infant brains are exquisitely sensitive to environmental poisons, especially ill-timed ones. This means that dismissing a tiny exposure as harmless because it is the equivalent of a drop of poison in 118 bathtubs full of water is naive. Such a vanishingly small dose is indeed enough to trigger lifelong disability in a fetus or infant. And in Chapter 4, I'll explain why. Pathogens diminish intelligence too, either by hampering the proper development of the brain or by directly assaulting the adult nervous system, or both. In Chapter 5, I'll show how and why these pathogens, from HIV to trichomoniasis, also preferentially afflict communities of color. In short, African Americans and other marginalized Americans of color are preferentially affected by chemicals known or strongly suspected to lower intelligence because they are far more likely to live in sacrifice zones, communities assaulted by environmental poisons and hazards. Addressing this chemical Armageddon will go a long way toward eliminating the racial IQ gap without changing anyone's genetics. There are solutions we can work toward as individuals, communities, and as a nation, and I will note these as well. It is important to realize that this book documents and discusses the greatly disproportionate impact of environmental hazards on racial minority groups, though it is not a burden borne solely by them. The recent finding that 90% of all Americans harbor pesticides or their byproducts in their bodies speaks to the universality of U.S. environmental exposures. But the reality is that race greatly exacerbates exposure and damages health, including both intellectual and mental health, in a dramatic manner. The intensity, breadth, duration, and harms of such exposures are greatly magnified in communities of color, although the news media and even scientific discourse have sometimes veiled this fact. There are a few topics that I address in lesser depth than I originally expected to, either because they go beyond the book's purview or because insufficient data limits an extensive discussion. Poverty, for example, is a potent thief of health and intellect, whether found alone or coupled with pollution. But although poverty likely potentiates disproportionate exposure to toxic environments, teasing out its influence, independent of poisonous exposures, requires research that has yet to be concluded. So, instead of discussing its independent impact at length, I've pursued the most meaningful evidence-based discussion in this book's context: the relative effects of poverty and race in determining who is exposed to brain-eroding substances and agents. This introduction and various later chapters address the cognitive harms of environmental agents on poor whites to the extent possible based on the available data. However, my ability to do so at length has been limited by the fact that publications on this group tend to focus on detrimental physical effects rather than cognitive ones. I was similarly disappointed by the dearth of data on farm workers' exposures, even by the government agencies responsible for protecting their health. The Latino laborers, and on the East Coast, African American migrant workers, suffer greater proximate exposure than do most other Americans, but this cannot be quantified and analyzed without sufficient data. Although this book discusses the effects of biological and psychological stress and cognition, it does not devote a lot of space to stress as an independent factor in cognition, which lies beyond the purview of a volume on poisoning wrought by the physical environment. Chapter 7, however, does explore recent research on the direct stress-mediating effects of the natural environment on mental health and cognition. A Terrible Thing to Waste explains that establishing convincing proof which is often presented as a purely scientific question, is very often an economic and political strategy deployed by industry and/or government to evade responsibility. Achieving scientific certitude is difficult given the plethora of variables and our often insufficient command of causal interrelationships. But if protecting lives and health is what motivates us, perfect certitude may not be the gold standard. And we will not blindly dismiss strong evidence of untested chemicals as mere correlation. When many studies of risk factors in the United States and abroad point to the same chemical culprits, this lends power to correlations and should be taken into account when deciding whether to approve their use. IQ antidote. If environmental poisoning is an important factor driving the IQ gap, and what most scientists think it represents, some damping of intellectual performance, the news is not all bad. At the very least, this means that the gap can in fact be closed. Nearly 100 years ago, we learned that iodine supplementation can enhance IQ, yet we failed to implement our knowledge, and so it remains the largest source of mental retardation. We cannot afford to make this mistake with environmental pollution. We can end human exposure to these poisons, and we must do so, for the sake of people of color and for the sake of our nation, because we cannot afford to throw genius away. We must give the political polemics a rest and turn our energy from debating racialized genetic slander to applying what we know in order to level the playing field. We must topple the barriers to optimal intelligence for all Americans. For more than a century, we've been assured that nothing can be done to restore the intelligence of groups who manifest evidence, such as lower IQ scores, that they are unprepared to compete in our fast-paced Western world, where the mastery of specialized skills, such as reading and mathematical analysis, has come to determine who will be a success and who will be resented as a burden on society. But something can be done. Intervention is not futile. Once we recognize the large extent to which lower cognition is laid to addressable medical factors, it is easy to see that IQ loss can be corrected by reducing exposure to environmental toxins, and that our nation would reap huge rewards for doing so. Intelligence is a product of environment and experience that is forged, not inherited. It is malleable, not fixed. By eliminating pervasive lead, mercury, hydrocarbons, industrial chemicals, prenatal exposures to alcohols, and even exotic pathogens like red tide algae poisonings, worm infestation, and trichinosis, we can save the assailed brains of untold people of color. As a bonus, by using techniques ranging from heavy metal and toxin abatement to educational enrichment to laws against industrial pollutants, we'll increase the health of our nation as a whole and likely also help address the dangerous effects of dire poverty. U.S. government action will also be necessary. A federal mandate could remedy the disproportionate racial exposures that hobble cognition. Closing or updating the last 4 mercury-based chloralkali factories in America, for instance, would save an estimated $24 million in economic productivity that is currently lost due to the human effects of mercury pollution. Unfortunately, the Trump EPA is moving in the opposite direction. In the waning days of 2018, it took aim at the Mercury and Air Toxic Standards, MATS, which under the Obama administration had funded the $18 billion cleanup of mercury and other toxins from the smokestacks of coal-fired power plants. After a required 60-day comment period, the EPA seeks to rescind the act, which it deems not necessary, although it and similar efforts have reduced mercury from coal-fired plants by a heartening 85% over a decade. The national debt. Somehow, the misperception has arisen that lowered IQ in ethnic enclaves affects only the people who live in them. However, As developmental toxicologist Bruce Lamphere has shown, a small 5-point decrement in collective IQ not only drags down the average intellect of a nation, it slashes in half the number of people who fall into the gifted category, while swelling the population of the mentally retarded or intellectually disabled by an additional 3.4 million. The IQ gap's persistence in the United States is part of the reason our intellectual rankings lag behind other Western societies with fewer resources. We rank on par with countries like Estonia and Poland, while top scores go to Japan, Australia, and Scandinavian countries. Some question how critical IQ is. We've long known that IQ measurements in the United States and around the world are dramatically biased. We also know that it is not possible to administer the test in a manner that gives meaningful comparisons across a wide variety of cultures. Beyond this, the meaning of intelligence varies from culture to culture. It is multifactorial, and IQ tests provide an admittedly limited and biased measure of achievement, not the oft-touted innate ability. In the context of this book, which focuses on the United States, it is exactly this testing of achievement that imparts some meaning to IQ tests. Christopher Epig, Ph.D., Director of Programming for the Chicago Council on Science and Technology, muses, "In the United States, the ability to use technology, to read and to use numbers is important, and IQ tests measure these well. In other, less technological societies, lower IQ scores may reflect the fact that reading and calculation are less important and less frequently practiced. I don't know how predictive IQ is of your success as a good hunter-gatherer or farmer," notes Brink Lindsay, author of Human Capitalism: How Economic Growth Has Made Us Smarter and More Unequal. "But it predicts whether you'll be a good office worker. Our nation has relatively few job openings for farmers. In today's technological society, the species of intelligence measured by IQ is what's deemed most germane to success. Although IQ scores are not a consistently accurate measure of intelligence, IQ is too important to ignore or to wish away. For Americans, IQ, usually measured by the Stanford, Binet, and Wechsler scales, although there are many variants, has proven a predictor of success in school, social settings, work achievement, and lifetime earnings, while emotional intelligence scores, for instance, are far less meaningfully linked to success. The median hourly wage of workers scoring on the highest level in related literacy tests, for example, is 60% higher than that of workers scoring at the lowest level. Those with low literacy skills are more than twice as likely to be unemployed. It's true that the association between IQ and academic and material success is less strong for marginalized minority group members because racial bias strongly drives success and failure as well. White men with high school educations earn more than black men who graduate from college, for example. But for minority group members, who are more likely than other Americans to be poor and underemployed, lower levels of achievement or income mask an especially dire situation. Globally speaking, the average American of any race or ethnicity is in trouble. In 2013, the Program for the International Assessment of Adult Competencies found that American adults scored well below the international average in math, reading, and problem-solving abilities using technology. 10% cannot use a computer mouse. Jacob F. Kierkegaard, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, summed this up. "There is a race between man and machine here. The question here is always, are you a worker for whom technology makes it possible to do a better job, or are you a worker that the technology can replace?" Recent research has confirmed that IQ predicts the growth and future success of nations, too. A 2014 Malaysian University study strongly suggests that people with the highest IQs have the most powerful influence on economic development. Even more than professionals engaged in research and development activities. But our unimpressive scores mean that Americans are less able than most people in other developed countries to solve problems in a technological environment. This isn't going to change anytime soon. The United States will continue to face difficulty catching up with China and India, our nation's current economic competitors, in part because state education funding has been slashed in recent years. The plea of impossibility. Yet, as some of us seek answers, futility is the common and disheartening refrain of the hereditarians, whose opinions have most fundamentally shaped the IQ debates. They claim that intelligence is innate and immutable and insist that nothing, not better health, not education, not reducing poverty, and presumably not removing the assortment of poisons assailing the bodies and brains of children, can be done to raise the IQs of ethnic groups. Nearly all of them specifically argue that investing in solutions to the IQ gap is a waste of money and resources, ignoring the successes of solutions like complete lead abatement, which has been demonstrated by longitudinal studies to preserve children's IQ, or pre-K enrichment programs such as Head Start, which are associated with bounds in economic performance. These unsupported claims of futility serve their proponents' various political agendas well, such as stemming Hispanics' immigration rather than enriching their education so it meets national standards, or explaining African Americans' second-class status as a function of their own innate limitations rather than as a function of systemic racism. But this fictitious futility does not serve the needs of the lead-poisoned boy who cannot learn to read, the girl whose desultory education has left her unprepared for the workplace, or the desperately poor rural family whose hookworms and privation have left their children with subtle brain derangement that may never be diagnosed, as I discuss in Chapter 5. Assuming that nothing can be done is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Nothing will be done by a nation that adopts this stance. Hereditarians well understand that clinging to the notion of futility absolves them from the responsibility to act. British philosopher Jeremy Bentham said it best. The plea of impossibility offers itself at every step, in justification of injustice in all its forms. Embracing futility sabotages the welfare of our nation on all fronts. A terrible thing to waste, environmental racism and its assault on the American mind, shifts the focus from political sniping to what science tells us about real, correctable threats to intelligence and about strategies to maximize the intelligence of people of color and of the nation as a whole. A wealth of empirical evidence points the way, but both camps have given it short shrift. It is imperative to be guided by data rather than by entrenched political agendas or the trading of ideological insults. We must also learn from past mistakes, such as the penny-wise and pound-foolish partial abatement of lead, mercury, and other intellect killers, in order to fully invest in our children and our nation's future. Despite the tensions that have driven our perception of this problem, we will rise or fall together, not as separate ethnic groups. Nations with higher average IQs have stronger economies and greater wealth. But money isn't everything. A 2014 report into the relationship between IQ and national progress noted, "Empirical studies have found that intellectual people, namely those that have a high IQ, contribute more to socioeconomic development in a society as compared to the average ability citizens. We ignore this fact at our peril." Part 1. Color-coded intelligence? Chapter 1. The prism of race. How politics shroud the truth about our nation's IQ. I am somehow less interested in the weight and convolutions of Einstein's brain than in the near certainty that people of equal talent have lived and died in cotton fields and sweatshops. Stephen Jay Gould. As she stood in the doorway of the class surveying a sea of small, mostly dark faces, Kathy suddenly realized that she was clutching her handbag tightly, too tightly. She forced herself to relax and offer a smile she did not feel. "I don't understand. Why is Edgar in a special education class?" Kathy knew her son was bright. He loved school, read well above his third grade level, and in New Jersey, he had always hovered near the top of his class. She had ascribed his recent moodiness and reluctance to attend school to difficulty adjusting to their move to Fort Lauderdale. But when she prodded him, he blurted, "They have me in the class for slow kids, like I'm a dummy. Some of those kids can't even read." Incredulous, Kathy dialed Terry March, Edgar's teacher, and was appalled to hear that he had indeed been placed in special education. "Why did no one tell me?" she demanded. "We need to talk." On her ensuing tour of the school, Kathy noted that nearly all the children in the gifted program were white and asked, "On what test scores are these placements based?" Terry explained that each instructor's assessment of the student, not standardized tests, determined placement. Kathy insisted, "My child is very intelligent. Test him." "Please, we can optimize Edgar's training in these focused classes and he'll perform better in the end. We must be realistic. The IQ gap is a fact, and that unfortunately explains the racial disparity we have here." "Training?" Now Kathy was really angry, and she whirled around to face Terry. "You don't know my son's IQ. I promise you that if he is not tested, I will pursue legal recourse." She turned to leave. "Thank you for your time." The next week, Edgar was tested and reassigned to a gifted class. In the following year, 2005, the Broward County Department of Education began administering standardized tests to all second graders. As a result, the number of gifted African American children in the district soared 80%, and that of gifted Hispanic children skyrocketed 130%. Shortly thereafter, the policy shift resulted in a tripling of both Black and Hispanic gifted students. None of the students' IQs, or genes, had changed. Mind the gap. The average 15-point Black-white gap in measured IQ, and the sort of rampant assumptions that Kathy faced, are more than fodder for political debates about inherent racial intelligence. The widespread and inaccurate belief that IQ limits are innate and permanent directly affects the trajectories of lives like Edgar's, often imposing a low ceiling on an individual's opportunities from an early age, despite our knowledge of environmental risks to IQ, such as iodine deficiency. The fact that iodine deficiency was responsible for a 15-point IQ gap between residents of different geographic areas should have impressed upon us the environment's power to create the same 15-point IQ gap between U.S. whites and African Americans, especially considering the extent to which this country remains geographically segregated along racial lines. We also should have noted that addressing a damaging environmental factor is an effective tool that allows us to close the gap. Iodine deficiency is far from the only environmental condition known to lower IQ, and it is very far from the most potent. Heavy metals such as lead, mercury, and arsenic, and nearly 150,000 untested industrial chemicals, including pesticides, phthalates, PCBs, halogenated hydrocarbons, alcohol, and more, have been shown to depress IQ, stymie intelligence, and distort human behavior. Moreover, copious scientific data documents how people of color suffer the effects of these brain poisons in wildly disproportionate numbers. Industrial waste dumps, workplace exposures, Superfund sites, and bus depots haunt their neighborhoods. Scientists are beginning to quantify these effects in a manner that supports the connection between IQ and environmental exposures in communities of color. Yet, we have largely failed to appreciate the well-documented connection between environmental exposures and lower intelligence and IQ. Certainly, we have failed to act upon it. Acknowledging the potent effect of environmental poisons on intelligence would contradict the hereditarian theories of innate, permanent inferiority as expressed by IQ scores, theories that are uncritically accepted by many. The hereditarian view of IQ dominates the national perception of IQ as a measure of human potential. As I mentioned in the introduction, hereditarianism's racially loaded position makes for grabby headlines, and those who oppose it spend a great deal of time in point-by-point refutations of arguments and insults, so that instead of promulgating a more accurate view of intelligence and IQ, we get a shrill, reductionist national conversation. This myopia robs us of a potent tool. The reduction and removal of human exposures to environmental poisons that cause damage far beyond cancers, lung disease, and other serious physical illnesses. They also damage the brain and lower intelligence, creating not only individual tragedies, but a needless collective loss of intelligence. For a better understanding of what IQ is and isn't, let's go back to the beginning for a brief look at the nature of intelligence and IQ. Intelligence seems necessary for material and social success, and is central to our idea of success in general. Personal freedom, good grades, holding a meaningful, profitable job, providing for our families, maintaining a rewarding social network, financial security, and generally navigating the complexities of modern life in the West. However, if you're not sure what exactly intelligence is, don't worry. You're in good company. When asked to look up from their tools and metrics to offer a definition, scholars who've devoted careers to refining our understanding of this mercurial attribute, or collection of attributes, struggle to define it. "That's a good question," responded one researcher I interviewed, pausing briefly before adding, "A very good question," and falling into silence. Christopher Epig responded, "The best definition that I've heard of intelligence is that intelligence is an emergent property of mental functioning. You can compare it to attractiveness, which is not based on one single trait, like the distance between someone's pupils. It emerges from thousands of traits upon a person's body and mind, and it's not even the sum of lots of things, but it's the interaction of these things that gives you an emergent property." "A good definition of intelligence?" "That's a great question," said Brink Lindsay. "I don't know. There's really no definition except performing well on IQ tests, although there is the speed of learning and retention, and how fast one processes information and how well one retains it." In 1969, Arthur Jensen threw down a modern hereditarian gauntlet when he alleged the genetic intellectual inferiority of African Americans to whites. In an essay for the Harvard Educational Review entitled, "How Much Can We Boost IQ and Scholastic Achievement?", Jensen opined that IQ scores indicate unchangeable, inborn, genetically inherited intelligence for all groups of people. Differences in IQ scores between races, he claimed, prove group differences in fixed native intelligence. But when asked to define intelligence, Jensen sidestepped the question, intoning, "Intelligence, like electricity, is easier to measure than to define." Most high school physics students could refute this nonsensical aphorism by explaining that electricity is a form of energy resulting from charged particles, either statically, as an accumulation of charge, or dynamically, as a current.
Context of white supremacy. That is our first audio segment. Harriet A. Washington's A Terrible Thing to Waste. We will pick up the subsection IQ Rankings by the Nation. That's what we'll pick up at for audio section number 2, IQ Rankings by the Nation. If you have questions, thoughts, comments from the first portion of the reading, the number to dial, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate as I was listening to the first segment and I was sending out posts for the program this evening, a listener saw this is the new book that we're reading. And it's a WTH. I just finished reading that. Reading is more important than watching television. Bravo. And I said, well, are we about to waste our time? Is this a bunch of nonsense? And he responded. He said, absolutely not. Very constructive. Found a lot of value in it. He said, specifically, I reside in the Baltimore area, and that might be a region that she's going to cover in more detail. So he said he found it very constructive, even though he thought I would have critique of certain wording, which I did for medical apartheid, but I still top five. We shall see. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I will get to the listeners. I just want to take 1 second because I did post a video. She was talking about Johnny Cochran, and I posted a video of him talking about the environmental white terrorism in Alabama, Anniston specifically. I think they have a recent report, like within the last 6 months or so, recent report about environmental racism in the same area. Anywho, but I posted the video about Johnny Cochran. When she, Harriet Washington, when she talked about getting the information that Johnny Cochran had died, and then the guy behind her also found out, and they were kind of commiserating together about his death, I remembered where I was when I found out Johnny Cochran died. I was on the phone with an aunt of mine. We were talking about something. I don't know what we were talking about. Something not very important. And I had the television on, and it was on CNN. You know how they have the little ticker at the bottom with different news reports going by. And so the ticker went by, and it said Johnny Cochran passed away. I said, oh, man, wow, Johnny Cochran just died. And my aunt, she says, why do you care about that? And I said, well, in addition to the O.J. Simpson trial. She says, yeah, well, what are you getting? And I said, well, wait a minute, you keep interrupting me. In addition to the O.J. Simpson, she said, what do you keep talking about? O.J. Simpson, what do you care? The child? I said, you keep interrupting me. Can you let me finish? I said, in addition to the O.J. Simpson trial, she said, yeah, I know he did the, I said, oh, my Lord, what is, can I finish a sentence, please? Can I finish a sentence? So she finally hushed, and I said, in addition to the O.J. Simpson trial, he worked pro bono to get Geronimo Gijaga out of prison. Former Black Panther member who had been falsely imprisoned for 27 years. We just read Mumia Abu-Jamal. 27 years Geronimo Pratt spent in greater confinement. And Johnny Cochran worked his case, and the same flagrant, blatant indictment of white supremacy racism that Harriet A. Washington talked about. Like, I'm not going to sit here and pussyfoot. I'm not going to use a whole bunch of nutty metaphors. I'm not going to call it white privilege and racial bias. Call things what it, or call things what they are. Put it that way. He did a phenomenal job of calling out COINTELPRO, and all of this was just made up lies to keep Geronimo Pratt in greater confinement for 27 years. Many, many reasons to recognize, appreciate the life efforts of Johnny Cochran. Reminded me of that episode where I was when I found out Johnny Cochran passed away. Couldn't even let me get a word in. Man. All right. 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Thomas in New York. If you have comments, questions, you should be with us, sir.
You can come back to this, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm taking a few moments to get the notes together. Other folks, if you have thoughts, or if you need more time, I reckon you can get it together. This is probably a book you should have. It's not super long, and it's relatively new, so might be a good one to have. Harriet A. Washington is a phenomenal author. If you've not read Medical Apartheid, you already know the next book that you should be reading. It is in the archives. You can go back and listen. One of the most important, in my top five. We mentioned it yesterday. I mention it all the time. Let's see. I'll go through some of the notes that I took for the first portion. William Shockley. How could I miss that? That kind of set, in fact, the first two notes that I took, she starts this here book, "Humankind has not woven the web of life. We are but one thread within it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves." Chief Seattle? What? What? I thought, is Seattle going to be mentioned in the book? Does she have a connection to Seattle? I'm sure she's done some guest lectures here at UW or whatever it is. But wow. So to start with that, and then nature has color-coded groups of individuals so that statistically reliable predictions of their adaptability to intellectually rewarding and effective lives can be easily made. Who said that? William Shockley? What? The same William Shockley that Dr. Welsing embarrassed publicly in a debate? That William Shockley? Like, wow. Gotta be the correct book. We are supposed to be reading this here, and I'd say any student of Dr. Welsing, oh yeah, that's a, knew she would have been really intrigued by this here book. But oh yeah, immediately said, yeah, this is what we're supposed to be reading. And we just watched Dr. Welsing with Mr. Shockley while we were at the Cows Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat in Florida. Snuggled in and had, I think I had a slice of sweet potato pie while we watched some of this in Florida. Moving on. Let's see. I super appreciated how she grounds the first portion of the book with William Shockley, that he is not an anomaly, that this has been a long tradition, that this is a core component of white culture for centuries now, coming up with all sorts. I was going to come up with other terms, but just make it plain. Creating a lot of lies to insist that black people are idiots, that we are the dumbest, most imbecile, the greatest group of imbeciles in the known universe, and because we are so ignorant, that justifies us being mistreated, whether it's William Shockley, Charles Murray and the Bell Curve, remember that one? It's tons of these. Thomas Jefferson and Notes on the State of Virginia, black people are about apes, you know, they're ignorant, wild, emotional folks, they don't have any higher level thinking. This is centuries, what I said, this is white culture. Black people are ignorant and they should be mistreated. We should terrorize them because they're so dumb. Grounding that this is so-called science, talk about pseudoscience. That this is the history of pseudoscience, insisting that black people are ignorant. In fact, there's so much of it that white people have written tons of books on how many lies that they have created to insist that black people are stupid and should be mistreated because they are. Incidentally, I'm always reminded of Mr. Fuller's, you don't ever jump up and down and get upset. She talks about that, people spending all this time to debate these folks and all that. You don't do that. What's the only thing I need to know? Okay, I'm the most ignorant, stupid person in the history of the known universe. I can't even spell IQ. That's true. Let's try it on. What should be done with me? And that's all you want. Nothing else. Don't feel bad about it. No argument. I don't need an extra test. I don't need to pull out my SAT scores or perfect attendance or anything. You're absolutely right. I'm the dumbest person ever. Now, what should be done with me? Because just because I'm dumb, does that mean I should be mistreated? That's another good one you can ask. Just because we're ignorant, should we be mistreated on those grounds? And pull out your recorder or whip out that pad and pen and write down the answer. That's really all you need. Answers to those two questions and let the rest of it ride. Continuing, also appreciated her pulling in the Moors and their thoughts about the whites that they had conquered in Spain. That's why I said I know Dr. Welsing would have had a whole lot to say about this. Didn't she talk about the Moors and their conquering of Spain? Impact of that with the bullfighting that you see now and their thoughts on black people in that part of the world, dark people in that part of the world. Dr. Welsing would have had a lot to say about this. Let's see. Next. That word, chaotic, I believe is the correct pronunciation. I'll give you the sentence. In tones of infinite regret, their screeds and interviews insist that devoting resources to closing the so-called IQ gap would be a chaotic and irresponsibly expensive task. That word specifically, I just pointed out because it keeps coming up. We just saw that word in Paul Robeson. And I said then that when I see a word like that, I generally think, well, because that's from Don Quixote. So they would expect you to have some knowledge of white literature, writings that white people adore and might be required to read if you attend some really prestigious white colleges, which I think the author Harriet A. Washington has, or certainly if you are a English major, you probably will have to read Don Quixote at some point and write a book on it. But just use of terms like that, I generally say, might not be a book intended for black people, because a lot of black people don't get opportunities to go to those really prestigious schools where you might be required to read Don Quixote and write a book on it, and thus would know this term. Let's see. Well, I guess one thing that I would point out, African Americans suffer the nation's highest level of iodine deficiency. I don't think that's an accident. Or she talks about something that could be corrected so easily, just with a supplement to table salt could, you know, greatly reduce that. Or eating more foods that are rich in iodine, broccoli, that's a great one, easy one. Spinach, another great one. Getting more of those great green leafy vegetables in your diet, that might help also. But anywho, one major point, and I think I said this in Medical Apartheid, you can check the archives, which I, again, Medical Apartheid, extraordinary work in my top five. I'm so glad that I read it. And in fact, I think I said repeatedly, it was an extraordinary privilege to read that book on the Cows Book Club with everybody and to get their comments. It was my first time reading it, and it was for a lot of other people too. Just what an experience. That being said, I did say, man, we are cutting white people some slack. Because remember, if you don't, if you read that book, she talks about at the beginning her painstaking years of research to compile Medical Apartheid. She started bumping into white people who were not supportive of her publishing a book about the history of white people terrorizing black people in their white lab coats. And in fact, they would say things like, oh, I don't know if you should publish this. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what you're doing here. What are you trying to say here? I don't know, Harriet. She has quite a few of those stories at the beginning of the book. I remember talking about that, and that's not understanding what it means to be white. White people are not interested in maximizing the intelligence of black people. In fact, Azor Savage, guest on this here program, she's listened in many times. When I heard her speak here in Seattle, she said that she would talk to white people. And they said, man, I believe white children have a right to better education than black children. They're not interested in maximizing the intelligence of little black girls and little black boys. They have no interest in that at all. They have no interest in closing the IQ gap. Black, what is the bell curve? Bestseller, Charles Murray. You Negroes are inferior, and that's that. And even if you're not, you're still a Negro, so what? So we're dominating. We're not interested in cleaning up any of these sites. All of this is deliberate. That's what we talked about yesterday. This is chemical and biological warfare. That is one thing that I would say. Either this is true or it's not. Either Gus T is here talking nonsense, being in error, giving out inaccurate information, or this is logic. This is deliberate. This is not happenstance that, oh man, you all got radon here. Oh man, you all got lead contamination here. Oh man, you all whatever. It just feel, oh man, you got a bus depot here. Oh man, your elementary school was built on top of a landfill. Oh, this is going to have ramifications for centuries. Oh, that's not an accident. That is deliberate. That's not racial bias. That's not a whoops, we didn't understand or we didn't grasp. Chemical and biological warfare. And that is huge. If that is true, then this would sound substantially different. It would not be oh, if they just recognize this and it'll be in everybody's interest to make these changes, because black people, if they are maximized, their intelligence will contribute to the betterment of America and the country. That's not how white people think at all. That 200 years of insisting that black people are ignorant, that what is the definition? Dedicated to white supremacy racism. When you have that understanding, if that's true, again, might not be, but the evidence seems to be overwhelming in that direction. The problem is still here. That's the theme of the book. Things are getting worse. It's not getting better. Donald Trump is getting worse, and it's going to be 4 more years of that, as I said. If that's true, that this is all deliberate, that this is chemical and biological warfare, this book would sound different. It would be, this is being done deliberately, and this is going to continue to be done, not just even if Trump gets another 4 years, this is going to be forever. It doesn't matter who's in the White House. That's what the system of white supremacy means. Until we correct this problem, white people will be committed to these sort of programs forever, toxifying and making sure that your brain computer has been completely impacted so that you're not able to think at an optimal level. Important one. Continuing. The Johnny Cochran, yeah, I thought that was so important. I think so many, even that right there, for the amount of things that Johnny Cochran did, that it's all boiled down to O.J. Simpson and we hate his guts. Not, oh, wow, Johnny Cochran was a titan against environmental racism before that was even an in vogue thing. Forget Greta Thunberg, Johnny Cochran did substantial work to help black people that is still assisting them to this day, and he's been dead, what, 15 years? Greta Thunberg wasn't even alive when this was happening. What does she have to say about black people in Alabama? What does she have to say about environmental racism? Anyway, Johnny Cochran, the fact that that's not even mentioned, that people don't, you know, he just gets boiled down to he helped that coon O.J. Simpson, and I hate his guts. We'll give him a cameo in the next whatever docudrama that they crank out about the Simpsons. O.J. Simpson, excuse me. Let's see. And what he talked about, or what she's labeling this, the precautionary principle, where they study it and study it and study it. That's again where I'm saying this is not a, oh man, we didn't know, we had to study and it took us a long time to get our lab results. No. This is, we already knew. We designed this same conversation that we had yesterday. We already knew breastfeeding was best. Probably already knew too that formula use is also associated with increased risk for a variety of harms, including diabetes and what they say about black people being all tubby and got all those health related issues. It's assumed they probably already knew this. Same thing with all of the whether it's the lead in Flint, the lead in Newark, New Jersey, Alabama, just pick the, it's assumed they probably already knew you got all kinds of toxins. We've been dumping waste here for the last 40 years waiting to warehouse you niggers here. That's kind of the way things go in the system of white supremacy. I could be in error, but again, I think that is important if that's what things really are, if that's what's happening here. Let's see. Says this is, I'm not giving out the page numbers because I have the ebook on this one. She says it's important to realize that this book documents and discusses the greatly disproportionate impact of environmental hazards on racial minority groups, though it is not a burden borne solely by them. And we have said this in the last book. I'm stopping the paragraph. I just covered this. I just had that deja vu. Remember that portion in Live from Death Row where they had somehow the prison water got contaminated? It was oil or something had leaked into the prison water. And they couldn't drink the water for a day. And Mumia said the same thing. We're all on the same planet and we all have to drink water. And I'm sure that housewives down the road in Pennsylvania, they went to make the coffee and gagged and, you know, their water was contaminated. And I said the same thing then. It's a substantial difference between the white people and you being on death row. That white woman, oh, gag, the water's been contaminated. Pause. I can go to the store. Let's get a fresh bottle of Evian. In fact, let's get 20 gallons of Evian delivered. Now, not every white person has that sort of economic freedom, but substantially more whites have that freedom than black people to navigate that problem until it's been corrected or filters or whatever else that they need to get. And pause, I also said, hey, you're in death row. You don't even know if this was a leak that impacted everybody or if they're just running an experiment on you in the prison, because they do that. You have to trust the information that they give you that, yeah, this affected the whole town, as opposed to we just poisoned you niggers and are waiting to see what type of impact it has on you. Anyway, same thing with this. Oh, yeah, we dump you niggers in the toxified area. And they go, I'll go back to where I read, the impact of environmental hazards on racial minority groups, though it is not a burden borne solely by them. The recent finding that 90% of all Americans harbor pesticides or their byproducts in their bodies speaks to the universality of U.S. environmental exposures. That is true. You have white sacrifice. Absolutely. You have runoff that happens even when you contaminate and you do the landfills. It will even spill over to the organic areas and that sort of thing. However, when you have a war, you mitigate, you minimize, and whites, again, they have enough systems set up for themselves where they can do things to detoxify their bodies, to take better care of themselves, so that they minimize the harmful effects of this toxic environment. Black people don't. It does not have the same effect at all. And I just come back to that same. I think it is dangerous. I think Yorugu, Dr. Marumba Ani, also in my top five, she talked about that. It's dangerous. I think when we don't have an understanding of racism, white supremacy, and what it means to be white, I think a lot of times we can, even in the face of having a lot of overwhelming evidence that suggests answers to those questions, what it means to be white, when we don't have a proper understanding of that, we can come away with a really flawed grasp of these problems and even thinking that there's going to be some form of cooperation from whites because they are suffering from this and just not understanding that, hey, whites are willing to sacrifice quite a bit as long as they can maintain domination over the niggers. And I'll stop there. I had a few other notes. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in. Let's see. We'll check retired firefighter. Had a hand up. Then we'll check Thomas in New York as well. Do you have comments, questions, sir?
Greetings, Beth. Greetings, everyone. I just tuned in. I don't know anything about this recent book. I suspect it's a non-white black female writer based on what I've been listening to. What's the title and what is it about?
Let me check in with Thomas in New York. It's about environmental racism. That way you can get caught up a little bit since you just tuned
in. That's good enough.
I didn't know you had just tuned in. My fault. But yes, non-white author Harriet A. Washington. Maybe you'll get acclimated as you hear a few more folks commenting about the text. And or you can hear the second audio segment if, you know, time permits and all. Good to hear
from you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Good to hear from. Also with us just in the retreat. We just watched William Shockley. That was one of you heard the beginning. William Shockley. We just freaking watched the video of him down in Florida.
That's right.
Not making it up, see? Thomas in New York. Did you need more time to collect your thoughts, sir?
Nope. I'm good, sir. I was having a bad connection. I had to hang up and call back in. I couldn't tell until you started talking, you know, and I was like, yeah. Right. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great. Yeah, Johnny Cochran. On the steps of the 42nd Street Library, which is an absolute modern marvel. You haven't seen it. You know, they got every book in the world. Sea moss has some of the highest levels of iodine. In the book, she mentioned Japan had a high iodine diet in iodine, and basically because they were, island bound. And that helped them during the World War II atomic bomb. However, they've depleted a lot of their iodine source with the Fukushima incident in 2011, with 400 tons of radiation contaminated water spilling into the water around the island every day since that date. So in the future, I'm wondering what's going to turn out of that. I did not know that that building over there was a waste plant. You know, she said the Harlem waste plant. I'm like, what? The waste plant? So I looked it up. And I'm like, that was a waste plant? So, yeah, very interesting. And had no idea. It's right there by Riverbank Park, which is primarily built for white people, actually, but very interesting. So I'm going to do some research on that. Growing up in New Jersey, a lot of the areas was contaminated. Even some of the places where they built high-end stuff for, you know, people was had chromium or something in the ground. So there was always a high level of contamination in New Jersey when I grew up. And I wasn't in North, so that was, you know, a lot. Big thing was chromium and another that was in the ground everywhere. And they had to do certain processes before they could build things. And it just made you think, what was the effects on people breathing that in all these years? Another environmental thing that I noticed that's taking place now in New York, and it only seems to be in the black areas I've gone to, is the little small 5G towers everywhere. And the health effects of the 5G towers is going to be astronomical. But it seems like they're testing them out in Harlem, the Bronx, and certain parts of Brooklyn. If you go to the white areas, they're not on top of the buildings or on top of the houses or on the street light lamps like they are in the black areas. So it's just very interesting. I think we're the testing ground for it. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Dr. Niana Rasayan, he's been a guest on the program many, many times over the years. He talked about electromagnetic smog and having all of these different electronic devices and the Wi-Fi signals and everything else, just being around all of these contraptions and that energy that has an effect on you. And I believe he was saying, particularly because we are black and that melanin, we are especially sensitive. She talked in the book about how babies are more sensitive to some of these chemicals and poisons and things. He talked about how black people can be more sensitive to some of these energies. That's why he talked about not having your phones and all that in your room, cell phones and, you know, mobile devices, your laptops, other tablets and all that stuff. Try not to have that in the area where you sleep so you can get that stuff away from you, that it's important. So those towers, it would not surprise me at all. And still learning. I suspect many non-white people that is the case, where they don't know where the waste sites are, what is this facility. They don't even know the type of toxins that are in their environment. That's how it works for many, many folks. They don't find out until years later, like, you know, what the problem is and, you know, how it's impacted their health. So consistent on the system, and might again be a reminder why Mr. Fuller recommends try to learn a little bit about everything, starting with where you are, trying to learn things. And what is that place? What does it do? How long has it been? Just try to learn things. You would be surprised. Everything generally leads back to racism, white supremacy in one way or another. Other folks, if you have questions, comments, suggestions, first portion of the reading, feel free. Looking at some of my other notes, just a couple other things I did want to make sure I got in. I thought that was hugely important, how she talked about how these chemicals, what I just said, how sensitive children are, their bodies, their brains are still developing, so that being exposed to even a small amount, it might be a white person in a lab coat once again, who comes and says, oh man, we did checks and, you know, everything is fine. You know, it's such a small, minuscule percentage that it won't have an effect at all. We promise. Cross our hearts. You know, we double checked it. We triple checked it. It's fine. To say, well, hey, if this is a young person and their brain, their body is still developing, if they get that chemical at the right time when that structure is developing, it can have a massive impact, even a small quantity. And how some of these other chemicals can impact brain development and brain functioning. Just being exposed to these chemicals. I don't know. That was not something that I thought about on a regular basis. I was thinking, yeah, they can poison you and that can disrupt health and cause all these problems, which is impacting brain functioning. You're not going to be thinking your best if you don't feel your best, but not even thinking like, oh, wow, there would be direct ways that it would impair your ability to think at a high level. Wow. Again, if this is deliberate chemical and biological warfare, particularly if it's exposure to young black children at a disproportionate rate, chemical and biological warfare. And again, now you can compare, part of that conversation yesterday was, if we're not going to do breastfeeding and we do infant formula, sometimes you have to combine infant formula with water, and they, if you're in Flint or Newark, New Jersey, they were talking about black people on the continent who had polluted water and mixed it with the formula and killed, you know, thousands of black children that died. Now you got the double whammy, which again, double whammy, which was planned. Chemical and biological warfare, if that's the case. Let's see, what else did I have? So we read the introduction and then a little bit of chapter one. All of my notes that I read thus far, things that I highlighted, were from the introduction. And then from chapter one, where she says, copious scientific data documents how people of color suffer the effects of these brain poisons, PCBs, halogenated hydrocarbons, alcohol, in wildly disproportionate numbers, industrial waste dumps, workplace exposures. That was another one that I hadn't really thought about, but I mean, it seems so glaring when she mentioned it, because black people don't get all those spiffy CEO jobs. Where we have the highest salary and get to put our feet up on the desk on the 50th floor of the building. We get the jobs during the cleanup and that sort of thing, where you're going to be exposed to the toxins, the poisons, trash your brain. Let's see. Workplace exposure, Superfund sites and bus depots haunt their neighborhoods. Scientists are beginning to quantify these effects in a manner that supports the connection between IQ and environmental exposures in communities of color. Some folks have even said that the type of food that you eat impacts the functioning of your brain computer. Again, if this is being done deliberately, we put them in these areas with all these poisons and we know they won't be able to think too well. We already know we're going to be piling them up with problems and giving them few resources, and they're not going to be able to think to solve these problems because we are destroying their brains. Chemical and biological warfare. I could be in error. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. Can you hear me, Thomas?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great. Yeah, man. I was shocked when I worked at the hospital, how many people came in due to chemical exposure, not just substance, you know, like a chemical substance that they took, but skin, all types of skin, you know, things that was wrong with the majority of black people. It was just very, you know, interesting. And so many black people with C. diff, which, you know, I would have to clean the room in a specific type of way. If I was on the beds that night, you know, it would take like 2 hours to clean that room, you know, if they had C. diff, because everything had to be bleached. And I'm like, what is this? You know, like, I never heard of this, but yeah, a bunch of chemical exposure. When I grew up in Jersey, my mother bought a townhouse. You know, she calls herself leaving the ghetto, and she moved two blocks away in a gated community. But either way, that gated community was a very popular stadium called, I believe it was Roosevelt Field. And during the 70s, when I guess the decline and all that, they started dumping all this type of waste there. And that's where they ended up building this complex at. And they supposedly put something down so won't contaminate the residents. And, you know, these were pretty expensive houses. These wasn't, you know, for black people, per se. You know, it was for whoever could afford them. However, each year, when you walk to the waterfront, it sinks about a quarter inch. So you could see, like, you can't even ride your bike on the path anymore because it's sunk in this area and it's up in that area. It was terrible. You could see the ramifications of some of this chemical stuff. But if they never built that there, like I said, the ghetto was only two blocks away. None of that stuff ever would have been contained. You know, that would have just been in the air. You know, my friends used to go down. I never went, but the older kids used to go down there before they built anything and play, you know, hop the fence. And, you know, it's just one of those things. And, you know, just how much, I think this is going to be a good book because we are exposed to so much stuff that we don't even know about. Some of these chemicals were used in war, you know, but they had to find ways to dispel them. An interesting point they made as well, and I, you know, kind of see this happening as the push to move jobs back to the United States. The jobs we were told were moved out of the United States because the plants had some type of chemical, you know, the United States wanted to be more environmentally friendly, so they moved all these jobs away. But now the Trump's, you know, plan to bring these jobs back. If you look at all the areas where those jobs were, those were the ghettos back in the day, Detroit, Cleveland, you know, where it ends up to be, turns out to be where, you know, Chicago, you know, where the black areas were. And if those plants come back, you know, it's right back to black people being in the midst of all those environmental, you know, chemicals and things in the air, in the water, as they dispel them and everything. So I think this came at a great time.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. I'm thinking we're going to enjoy this book as well. Really, any book. One, I've done such a terrible job in covering environmental racism that that alone will make this a good read, because that will start slowly compensating for a glaring omission at the cows. But two, just still learning. Like I said, I feel just in the introduction and the little bit of chapter one that we've read so far, I feel like, wow, I have learned quite a bit, things that I wasn't even thinking of. So, yeah, I'm excited to keep reading. And a listener who just finished this book said, oh, yeah, you all will enjoy. Critique and read on. We call her from Cancer Alley, speaking of chemical and biological warfare. Irie, Louisiana, do you have commentary? Let's see. Irie, did you have commentary, or are you just listening? I saw you had a hand up.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, all right. Hello, everyone. I didn't catch the actual excerpt. So what book is it that you're reading?
Harriet A. Washington's A Terrible Thing to Waste. It's about environmental racism.
Okay, because I did come in on you all talking about exposure to various things. What I do personally, I take selenium. It's supposed to help eliminate free radicals. I also know that potassium iodide is a natural defense against radiation, which accumulates first in the thyroid. So that's something people can note. So maybe they take it in small doses, or however, if they research it, they can take it to defend against radiation. When I lived in Waukegan, Illinois, a friend of mine drove around and was like, yeah, this whole neighborhood used to be a landmine. And I used to listen to Wisconsin Public Radio because I used to live at the border, all of Lake Michigan. is a Superfund cleanup site. And at the top in Zion, Illinois, is a defunct nuclear power plant. So that's part of the reason why it's a Superfund cleanup site, along with all those ships going back and forth for leisure and commerce in the water. And I just wanted to let you know before I my turn, Gus, that 48 Laws of Power is available as an audiobook on YouTube, so no one will have to narrate if you come around to deciding to do that next. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you, everyone.
Much obliged. Yes'm. I had 48 Laws of Power. It was about four different books that I was trying to cycle through, and somehow things tipped to Harriet A. Washington for now, but 48 Laws of Power was right there and probably will be done, so we can move on, get that one read and out of the way for 2020. Let's see. Henry in Chicago, narrator, thanks out for helping with the narration with the Robeson book. Did you have commentary on A Terrible Thing to Waste? You should be with us, sir.
All right. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Very interesting book. I was listening to it. I need to get it so I can follow along real carefully because I think environmental racism is very important. In particular, here in Chicago, there is a section on the south side of Chicago called the Algar Gardens. It is basically nicknamed the Toxic Donut. There's literally about 50 landfills in that area, roughly about 100 industrial sites, and I think they said there's about a hundred toxic leakages, I think, in that area. And what's so interesting is, and especially during the summertime, there's a highway, the Bishop Ford Freeway, where if you drive down in that area, you can basically smell the waste from the expressway. And the landfills are like right off the expressway. So and that area is particularly, I would venture to say, about 99 to 100% non-white residents in that area. So that's something that you know Chicago has been dealing with in regards to toxic waste sites, in particular in an area where I would venture to say not just non-white people, but non-white Black people live there. Interesting about Johnny Cochran, when they're talking about Cochran, because, you know, you always hear about Cochran being, you know, the O.J. Simpson lawyer. You never hear about him, this case about the, the Alabama case, that was mentioned. I didn't know about that. But, you know, it's something that, you know, is, you know, something new that you learn about Johnny Cochran, along with, you know, him defending Geronimo Pratt and, you know, other things that, you know, nobody else talks about in regards to Johnny Cochran's work. And the situation with Edgar being put into special ed. Now, I might be wrong, but I thought children aren't supposed to be put in special ed without the parents' permission. So I was kind of surprised when they were telling the story about it, that the mother had found out that the boy had been put in a special ed, and she was surprised that they, you know, did it without their permission. So I thought that was illegal. I don't know if it's by state or, you know, federal law, but I'm pretty sure I saw that it was illegal to do something like that. That is actually too one of the tactics of white supremacists to, especially when you're talking about, you know, like environmental and biological terrorism, because one of the things that they do, you know, especially diagnosing our children with ADHD is they give them Ritalin and Risperdal and Adderall and all kind of other harmful chemicals to our young boys and girls. And then lastly, too, speaking of biological terrorism, we just recently passed, well, not recently passed, but it went into effect January 1st that recreational marijuana is now legal in Illinois. So that is another tactic of, biological and chemical warfare against us with the legalization of marijuana here in Illinois. So, but that's all I have right now in my life.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. I just want to say real quick, that was so important about Edgar. Man, this is such an important book. Good pick. Good. That was why there was a lean to this one over the other four we were looking at, although they are equally good books, I think, as well. But the story about little Edgar down in Florida, we were just there for the yoga retreat. I don't know if it's illegal or by state, but it's not by chance. It's not by accident that, oh, yeah, the little colored boy, we just toss him in the class, in the remedial class, because he can't read. He's just a little colored boy, probably just thinking about raping somebody. Yeah, we'll just put him over here. And, of course, we didn't tell his mom. She's on crack. Welfare, we just talked about that yesterday. He's on crack. She's on crack. Probably selling crack, too. Having all these illegitimate children. Just put him over in the remedial class. It's fine. It's fine. And then she goes, oh, we're training Edgar. It's fine. We're training him. It'll be great. You catch him. I'm like, what are you talking about? And again, if you play around with sex, the joke is on Edgar. You have your child in the killing fields, the white public schools. That's what's going to happen to Edgar. And she talked about black males specifically. I can't believe I forgot that point where she talked about, did all that caping for black males. Did y'all miss that? Where she was sat up there? I'll make sure I find that portion again. But I thought that was important. And I want to make sure I get my F in before I get our other caller. Man, Gusty has failed spectacularly with environmental racism, Chicago specifically. I have the book on my shelf right now, Packing Them In. An Archaeology of Environmental Racism in Chicago, 1865 to 1954. It's not by accident you got the toxic donut. And it's by a black person, no less, Sylvia Hood Washington. No excuse for not trying to get her on the program. I got the book right there. Title again, Packing Them In, An Archaeology of Environmental Racism in Chicago, 1865 to 1954. Now, this book would suggest that, hey, this is not by accident. We planned the toxic donut and sites like that. 1865, that's when the Civil War ended. Anyway, if you live in Illinois, that book should definitely be in the library. Caller that dialed in from a block number, did you have comments here to share?
Oh, may I be heard?
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Ira mentioned that she takes selenium, and that's a really good mineral, but I would caution her and everyone to be very, very careful. I think you're not supposed to take more than 400-something UD or something like that, but just to research what the maximum is that you should take per day. Because if you don't and you overdose on that, you will be very, very sick, and you will be very, very sick for a long time. And that's what I have. I have a selenium poisoning because I overdosed on selenium by eating too many Brazilian nuts, and too many was like more than four, which is just absurd. I mean, they're so high in selenium. So it's very easy to overdose on selenium. And it just takes a long time to get the just that mineral out of your system. Once you have too much of it, to where, you know, for several months I've had debilitating just sickness and excruciating pain, and I still have probably some months to go. And as a result, it's been very difficult for me to. Tonight in particular, because I'm not having a very good night in terms of, or even day health-wise with this poisoning that I have. And I am healing, but it's just not a good day today. And so it's been very difficult for me to concentrate on, you know, listening to the audio portion. So I've just tried to do the best that I could to just listen to the commentary. And I hope, you know, because how I feel, the sickness is very kind of off and on. And so I hope, you know, the next portion I can listen to it. But if not, I'll listen to it, you know, when I'm feeling better. But I'm just doing the best that I can, because I do think that just this type of book is constructive. And Harriet Washington is a brilliant author. And I just wanted to quickly say, there's no reason to be upset with Johnny Cochran. I mean, or even O.J. Simpson. He was accused of killing a race soldier. There's nothing to be upset about with that. And what it boiled down to is that the race soldiers, they thought that black women, who was the majority of the jury, was going to be so upset at O.J. Simpson for being with a white female, and that didn't happen. And they did the correct thing, because he's innocent. He was innocent. He didn't kill her. And Nicole Simpson, she was a drug addict, and she was into a bunch of crazy stuff. And one of the crazy people, or one of the race soldiers that she was involved with, or maybe even several of them, these very bad people, they're the ones who killed her. And as far as the last thing I want to say in terms of you know, Johnny Cochran, like you said, I think that, first of all, that he was murdered by race soldiers, and they just said he was sick or whatever. And I think that the reason he was murdered is because he got O.J. Simpson off, which was what he should have done, because O.J. was innocent. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Thank you for taking the time to call in, even when your health is not its best. And I've commented about that before, that even some of these poisons, toxins, even if they don't directly attack your brain functioning, when you don't feel your best, it's difficult to think your best. It's difficult to concentrate. It's difficult to pay attention. It's difficult to be imaginative, creative, when you're in pain. That's your focus. Just, man, I'm tired of being sick. I'm tired of being in pain. That also minimizes, reduces your IQ, if you want to call it that, or intelligence. But thank you, under tough circumstances, for dialing in to share. And absolutely, Johnny Cochran, absolutely. And in fact, not just with O.J. Simpson, I'm sure he probably upset some people with getting Geronimo Pratt out of prison and the way that he talked about that case. I'm sure he upset some white people with his work helping black people who were victims of chemical and biological warfare in Alabama. They could have joined forces. We could have had some unjust networking. Everybody, Alabama, California with the O.J. Simpson, and the folks with the Panthers, J. Edgar Hoover, COINTELPRO, lots of white people upset with this Negro. Any final comments before we get to the second audio segment?
Somebody going in, I'll mute my line.
I was confused. I was just trying to see. Did you? But I mean, if you had something, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to quickly say, you're welcome. And I only raised my hand because I wanted to warn everybody about the selenium. I'm feeling so bad that I wouldn't have even probably said anything at all. But I just don't want anyone to suffer what I'm suffering and deal with what I'm dealing with. And I'll mute my line. But you're very welcome. And this is an incredible program. So it's my honor to be a part of it. I'll mute my line.
Hello, Gus.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I just want to let Ivy know that I take 200 micrograms a day. It's Sol-Ray selenium, and it's only 200 micrograms a day. And sometimes I even don't take it, because I heard from somebody what you said, that you can overdose on it. So I'll even, like, go maybe a 2 or 3 days without taking it. But everything deserves research. So, but thank you for the warning.
Oh, you're very welcome, and I'm very glad to hear that. I'm with my life.
Learn a little bit about everything. Mr. Fuller did say that. Try to learn something about everything. I did find that passage. It's true that association between IQ and academic and material success is less strong for marginalized minority group members because racial bias, dedication to white terrorism, strongly drives success and failure as well. White men with high school educations earn more than black men who graduate from college, for example, but minority group members who are more likely than other Americans to be poor and underemployed, lower levels of achievement or income mask an especially dire situation. And she will have more to say about black males in the book and how they are treated specifically. But I did think that one was important. Anything else folks need to get in? In fact, just make a note and we will save it for the second segment. We'll go ahead and get started again. IQ of Nations, that's what we're picking up at in chapter one. Let's see. Yeah, IQ Rankings by the Nation, subtitle that we're picking up on. Again, this is Harriet A. Washington's A Terrible Thing to Waste, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number two.
IQ Rankings by the Nation. Jensen's inability to define intelligence didn't stop him from joining his forebears in ranking some Asians and Europeans near the top, and the diverse denizens of Africa, from Nigerian urbanites to Tanzanian scientists to Kalahari Bushmen to Congo pygmies to Ethiopian Jews, near the bottom of an IQ gradient that persists today. Researchers write of intelligence, but they measure IQ, and they are not synonymous. There is no direct test of general mental ability. What IQ tests measure is the display of particular cognitive skills such as vocabulary and reading comprehension, explains Christopher Epic. Any conclusions about general mental ability are inferences drawn from the test taker's mastery of those various skills. In 2002, when IQ and the Wealth of Nations by Richard Lynn and Tatu Van Hannon ranked nations by their average IQ scores, most of Europe and the more affluent portions of Asia hovered a bit above 100 points. But the news for Africa, Hispanic nations, and South America was grimmer. Average IQs for most African states fell below 70, except for South Africa, which came in at 72, although Ethiopia's score of 63 was later revised to 71. Equatorial Guinea defined the nadir at 59. The authors suggested that these nations' low average IQs denoted low intelligence among their citizens, which in turn explained the poverty and scant economic development in sub-Saharan countries. Low intelligence, indeed. By most measures, an IQ below 70 denotes mental retardation. Thus, Lynn and Van Hannon claim that nearly all of Africa is mentally retarded. Critics pointed out that their conclusion was unsupported by the data. Their methodology lacked rigor, was illogical, and their IQ calculations used very small, non-representative populations and were often derived from older papers and assessments of dubious credibility. But even if their methodology had been sound, their conclusions would still have been unreliable. As Brink Lindsay points out, the very concept of comparative IQ scores is flawed. IQ scores are only a good indicator of relative intellectual ability for people who have been exposed to equivalent opportunities for developing those skills, and who actually have the motivation to try hard on the test. IQ tests are good measures of innate intelligence if all other factors are held steady. But if IQ tests are being used to compare individuals of wildly different backgrounds, then the variable of innate intelligence is not being tested in isolation. Instead, the scores will reflect some impossible to sort out combination of ability and differences in opportunities and motivations. Guillermo Berhanu, a professor of education at the University of Gothenburg, agrees, adding, "Statistics can lead us to accurate conclusions only by using representative samples that are selected at random." In Ethiopia, however, the average IQ score was calculated based on a sample of a mere 134 children in a single orphanage in Jemma. As Berhanu wrote, an orphanage in Jemma in 1989 was an extraordinary and traumatic experience for children who were victims of famine, resettlement, and on a massive scale. The experience of orphaned children who survived harrowing experiences of death and starvation cannot be seen as a representative sample for IQ testing. Thus, Lynn Ann Van Hannon's rankings are nonsensical, because the developing world sites used in establishing IQs have so very little in common with Western and affluent Asian nations. In many such countries, compulsory education and literacy are relatively rare. And not all the tested subjects were fluent in English or in the language in which the test was administered. As Berhanu points out, the social conditions in very poor and unstable countries can militate against success in test taking. The incentive to perform well on such lengthy, grueling tests is strong for Americans, who know that their future success in academia and industry hinges on a high score. This motivation doesn't exist among test subjects in developing nations, who are almost certainly correct in seeing no connection between a high score and their lot in life. Moreover, health status stands between the people of the Global South and a normal IQ score. Poor nutrition alone depresses brain development and intellectual functioning. So does exposure to neurotoxic agents, which is ubiquitous in countries where industrial emissions are rampant and all but uncontrolled. This means that even had testing practices in these countries been logical, meticulous, and fair, environmental factors alone would still cause a disparity in IQ scores. In this respect, the denizens of low IQ nations have a lot in common with residents of lower IQ ethnic enclaves of the United States. They suffer exposure to the same sort of brain-damaging chemicals as do members of U.S. racial minority groups, and with the same potent but underappreciated effect on their cognition and intelligence as is apparent in their depressed IQ scores. The various IQ tests used in Lynn's book, and still in use elsewhere, have something else in common. They measure abilities that are important to success in Western culture and that are more commonly practiced in relatively affluent Western cultures than in other nations and cultures. The tests, for example, focus heavily on reading skills, which are not important in every culture. Developing nations that ranked low in IQ often lacked compulsory schooling, and many of those tested were rural agrarians who had rarely, if ever, held a pencil. Some dismiss such rankings as not only scientifically flawed, but racist, or at least ethnocentric, especially because many of the hereditarians who espouse them are funded and supported by politically active groups with eugenicist or anti-immigrant leanings, such as the Pioneer Fund. It's worth noting that Asians, not Europeans, often occupy the very apex, so that these rankings serve to denigrate dark-skinned people, not to elevate the palest people. Yet, racist can be an unhelpful assessment. Surveys show that various groups define the term quite differently, so it often impedes rather than clarifies communication. Moreover, even if such IQ assessments are motivated by racial disdain, this doesn't prove them wrong. IQ is a crude, inaccurate, and biased proxy for intelligence, but most scholars agree that it measures something to do with the capacity to learn, at least in the affluent West. The error of assuming that IQ scores indicate inborn lower intellectual capacity dictated by race is a product of bias, intentional or otherwise, that inaccurately depresses some groups' IQs. However, this belief is also due to misunderstandings about what IQ can and cannot measure. If, for the sake of argument, we assumed that the global rankings are more accurate and valid than they are, then there would be a reason that the IQ of the average Ethiopian is lower than that of the average U.S. resident. And knowing what this reason is would be a necessary first step toward a corrective. Hereditarians say the reason is that inferior IQ means that the intelligence of racial groups such as African Americans and Hispanics is innate, primarily genetic and so impervious to prevention, and immutable, and cannot be ameliorated through better education or better physical and mental health. Perhaps these assumptions, not the findings of lower relative IQs, are the most damning tenets of hereditarian dogma. Perhaps it is not the fictitious assessment of lower IQs that is most malignant, but rather the unsupported assumptions about the nature of IQ and intelligence that invest the IQs with dire meaning. The Rising Tide. Fortunately, the hereditarians are wrong. The facts belie all their beliefs. IQ is not innate. Studies that compare the IQs of mixed-race children reveal the determinant role of their various environments. In Germany, children with one parent of African descent and one of European descent, who were raised in white households, such as the offspring of African-American or African soldiers whose fathers returned to the States and whose mothers subsequently marry white Germans, scored higher on IQ tests than mixed-race children from similar backgrounds who were raised in black households. The same thing happened when comparing mixed-race children in the United States. IQ is not genetic. Most experts consider intelligence to be multifactorial, and no genes have been proven to determine IQ. Furthermore, although we know that genetics are an important factor in most aspects of human health, the early experience of the brain and nervous system is far more important when it comes to intelligence. Pertinent studies include a German research study in which the overall average IQ of biracial boys with a white father was found to be 96, while that of such boys with a black father was found to be 96.5. Virtually identical, even though the latter group's boys were subjected to racial prejudice. A U.S. study compared black and biracial children adopted by middle-class black or white parents with similar results. Genetic potential is just that, potential. And whatever potential a given fetus has, exposures and deprivation can ensure that his or her future IQ will be lower than average, sometimes devastatingly so. Whether a child in utero is exposed to alcohol during a key moment of development, assaulted by PCBs, arsenic, or mercury, or assailed by a pathogen associated with the loss of cognition or memory, it is the brain's experience, not genetics, that will dictate the child's intelligence and IQ. IQ is not impervious to change. We have been watching average IQs change within populations for decades in the West, as well as in some of those irremediably low IQ nations. Consider Kenya. IQ tests were administered twice in certain regions of Kenya, once in 1984 and again in 1998. The later test reported an average IQ at least 14 points higher than the first. This increase occurred far too swiftly to have been driven by genetics. However, this spike in average IQ coincided with a period of dramatic improvement in health status in the regions, including lowered rates of infectious disease. It is highly unlikely that these improvements were unrelated. In fact, this IQ increase is a variant of the Flynn effect, named for James R. Flynn, whose 2012 book, Are We Getting Smarter? Rising IQ in the 21st Century, documented an average IQ rise of 3 points per decade between 1932 and 1978 in the United States and some other Western nations. Subsequent analyses have confirmed this, such as a 2014 meta-analysis in the Psychological Bulletin, which calculated the same IQ gains between 1972 and 2006. This suggests that the scores reflect not innate intelligence, but acquired skills. So, IQ is indeed malleable. We just need to determine what causes it to change. If we do that, we will be empowered to craft strategies and tools for raising it within marginalized ethnic minority groups of African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans, just as we raised the low IQs within pockets of America by using iodine supplementation. Necessary bias. If IQ measures acquired skills rather than innate ability, if it is affected most strongly by environmental forces, not transmitted by genetic ones, and if it depends upon a shared culture and strength of motivation to tell us anything meaningful about ability, why do some cling to notions that a racial difference in IQ means an innate, unchanging difference in African-American intellectual potential? To understand this, it is important to realize that the belief in the innate, irreversible, intellectual inferiority of people of color predated any objective tests or measurements of their abilities. As I explain in Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, the assertion that African Americans and some other people of color were inferior, and perhaps not even human, was a necessary myth for justifying enslavement, and was supported by the 19th century's most prominent U.S. scientists, the American School of Ethnology. Intellectual inferiority was a key tenet of that inferiority, repeated often in the scientific and popular literature. 19th century scientists portrayed the enslaved African American as inherently debased and permanently so. No amount of training, education, or good treatment could make him the equal of a white man. Most of these scientists were polygenists, who thought that African Americans and whites belonged to different species. They held that Black Americans were physically inferior, dishonest, malingering, hypersexual, and indolent. This inferiority was documented in entire catalogs of Black flaws that filled medical journals and textbooks. In 1839, Samuel George Morton published Crania Americana, a book written to demonstrate how human skull measurements, or craniometry, revealed a hierarchy of racial types. Morton determined that Caucasians had the largest skulls, and therefore the largest brains, and Blacks the smallest. His tests were the forerunner of phrenology, which sought to determine character and intelligence by interpreting the shape of the skull. 9 years later, Louisiana's Samuel A. Cartwright, M.D., suggested that Blacks' physical and mental defects made it impossible for them to survive without white supervision and care, alleging that the crania of Blacks were 10% smaller than those of whites, preventing full development of the brain and causing a stunting of the intellect. A French scientist, Louis-Pierre Gratiolet, added that in the Negro, the cranium closes on the brain like a prison. It is no longer a temple divine, to use the expression of Malpighi, but a sort of helmet for resisting heavy blows. IQ is measured by a myriad of examinations that purport to evaluate and score a person's intelligence, partial or entire. Haunted by race bias, class bias, and a plethora of common misapplications, the IQ test is a widely applied but very imperfect yardstick, useful in measuring intelligence, but only within a limited context. And how could it be otherwise? A pervasive American belief in the intellectual inferiority of people of African descent and of formerly colonized peoples predates any tests formulated to document it. These include people we would now group under the labels of Hispanic Americans, as well as some Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. From the beginning, racial measurements of intelligence have been plagued by rigged research and other misapplications of science designed to enforce racial bias, as Stephen Jay Gould documented extensively in The Mismeasure of Man, and as Robert V. Guthrie reveals in Even the Rat Was White, A Historical View of Psychology. Continued belief in the inferiority of people of color has survived even the grossest logical failures and embarrassing revelations of racial bias. Mental fitness by numbers. National data used to dictate policy have also been manipulated in bad faith, as when the 1840 U.S. Census employed falsified data to promulgate a pro-enslavement message of racial mental inferiority. The census data purported to show that freedom was unhealthy for the limited minds of African Americans and caused freedmen to suffer 11 times the mental disease of their enslaved peers. It took James McCune Smith, M.D., a Glasgow-trained African-American physician and statistical scientist, to refute the scientific racists on their own ground, and he found it necessary to do so frequently. His 1837 lecture exposing the scientific fallacy of phrenology offered scathing criticisms of the logical sins inherent in imputing character and intelligence from physiology. And his 1844 report to the U.S. Senate entitled The Memorial of 1844 to the U.S. Senate exposed the intentional bias and manipulation used to impugn African-American intelligence in the 1840 census data. Guthrie reveals many instances of such racial bias in test-taking. Among them, the administration of identical intelligence tests to armed forces recruits in the 1920s. Whites and blacks were given the same test, but middle-class and upper-class whites took a paper and pencil alpha test, whereas blacks and some poor whites were assumed illiterate, so the test questions were given by demonstration and pantomime, acted out by proctors in the beta variant of the test. Clarity was sacrificed because at least some abstract test questions were utterly unsuitable for miming. Other army tests utilized picture completion exercises that rated the soldier's ability to draw the missing element in an image, such as the balls in the hands of bowlers and the missing net in a depiction of a tennis game. For a sharecropper's son on his first foray outside the Deep South, these were likely to be unfamiliar objects. Among the black and lower-class participants, the test generated a great deal of confusion and very low scores. W.E.B. Du Bois observed, "For these tests were chosen 4,730 Negroes from Louisiana and Mississippi, and 28,052 white recruits from Illinois. Emphasis original. The result? Do you need to ask?" M. R. Tribouille, Director, Bureau of Educational Service, Columbia University, assures us that the intelligence of the average Southern Negro is equal to that of a 9-year-old white boy, and that we should arrange our educational program to make waiters, porters, scavengers, and the like of most Negroes. During the 1920s, eugenicists influenced the passage of the National Origins Act of 1924, which barred immigrants from Southern European countries as dysgenic. This line of thinking persists to this day. Within the past decade, hereditarian Jason Richwine sought to convince lawmakers to similarly restrict immigration from Hispanic nations partly on the basis of their supposedly lower intelligence. Richwine's 2009 Harvard doctoral dissertation, entitled IQ and Immigration Policy, claimed that Hispanic immigrants had lower IQs than non-Hispanic whites, a disparity that he claimed persisted for generations. The belief that IQ scores are hereditary, that they measure general intelligence, that they are innate and fixed, and that they can be compared across groups, are assumptions that have been made for more than a century, without proof. Today, they are made in spite of proof to the contrary, as recent research has roundly dismantled most of these myths about IQ. Such myths should never have been embraced. In fact, they contradict the very research, goals, and findings of the man who invented the notion of IQ. IQ origins. The psychologist Alfred Binet, originator of the 20th century intelligence test known as the Stanford-Binet intelligence test, was frustrated in his initial attempts to create a bias-free intellectual assessment based on craniometry, the standard method at the time. He traveled from school to school measuring cranial sizes and attempting to correlate them with student performance, noting that teachers made the subjective assessments of which students were stellar or underperforming. But such determinations were validated by no objective measure. Binet found only minuscule differences in performance relative to cranial size. Mere millimeters separated the brightest from the dunce, and this was not useful in predicting intellectual performance. In 1904, the French Minister of Public Education asked Binet to find ways of identifying the specific cognitive problems affecting poorly performing school children, so that ways of addressing and improving their individual learning issues could be devised. Binet did so, this time rejecting craniometry in favor of a tool he developed himself, specifying that it was to be used only to evaluate the learning disabled and low academic achievers. He assigned children brief, scored tasks of counting and reasoning, and used the scores to determine what he called their mental age. By subtracting this mental age from the child's chronological age, Binet arrived at a quotient, an individual measure of academic achievement. The intelligence quotient, or IQ, was born. From the beginning, Binet insisted that the test was valid only for measuring the weaknesses of pupils who were already performing inadequately, not for predicting who might perform inadequately. He always denied that it could be used for the latter purpose. In fact, writes University of Wisconsin-Madison professor of law and bioethics Pilar Osario, Binet rejected the notion that his test measured a person's inborn or fixed cognitive ability. He also declined to use his test to rank individuals according to cognitive ability. What Binet feared most about an IQ number, wrote Robert Anemone, a biological anthropology professor at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, was its negative uses in society. He thought that it could be used as an indelible label rather than a tool to identify the needs of the child. Therefore, Binet declined to label IQ as inborn intelligence and refused to regard it as a device for ranking individuals based on the mental capacity. Of course, this is precisely how the IQ test is used today, as a device for ranking individuals' mental capacity and stamping them with an indelible label. While a history of IQ testing is beyond the scope of this book, it is helpful to understand that later psychologists adopted Binet's IQ test for the very different purpose of assessing the intellectual capacity of anyone. And this was just the first of many misinterpretations of what IQ can and cannot tell us. Thus, the chief principles of Binet's IQ test were reversed as early psychologists translated his scale into a universal tool for testing all children. They further assumed this score to be fixed for a person's entire life and hereditary, handed down from parents to child, all without evidence. So do contemporary American hereditarians. Twin fallacies drove this misapplication of the IQ test. Reification, which bestowed an independent determinative and predictive reality and power on the test, and hereditarianism, the assumption that IQ is inherited, passed from parents to child. These assumptions fit well into the pervasive pre-existing racial mythologies that already held the intellectual inferiority of the lower races to be rigid and heritable. IQ became another tool to validate and reinforce their lower station in life. Today, many intelligence tests give a single intelligence quotient, held to be a measure of general intelligence. IQ tests purport to measure only fluid intelligence. Fluid intelligence is associated with the ability to solve problems that require no prior knowledge, such as abstract logic puzzles that one has never seen before, and for which one has no context. Crystallized intelligence, on the other hand, is related to one's ability to use learned knowledge. IQ questions regarding vocabulary and analogies, which can more readily be answered by those who have read widely and know a lot of words, fall into this category. So, IQ tests actually measure both fluid and crystallized intelligence. As Brink Lindsay notes, fluid scores peak by the 20s, but crystallized intelligence continues to improve until approximately age 60. Head Start and other pre-K enrichment programs boost both crystallized and fluid intelligence. Other tests measure discrete aspects of intelligence, such as verbal abilities. The SAT, which measures crystallized knowledge such as literacy, mathematical and writing skills, and the ability to solve problems that are needed for academic success in college, is often used as a proxy for an intelligence test. Even though the SAT does not purport to measure intelligence potential, but rather acquired skills. The hereditarian arguments now hinge upon an average 15-point gap between U.S. white and African-American IQ scores. Because the intelligence IQ measures is genetically passed from parent to child, they argue, the lower IQ scores of African-Americans must be genetic, and thus cannot be improved by early or intensive education. Some people even assume the average gap between African Americans and white scores applies to all individuals, as Edgar's teacher, described earlier in this chapter, may have done when she cited the IQ gap as the reason for his baseless school placement. Hereditarian claims are refuted in detail by contemporary works such as J. L. Kincheloe's et al.'s Measured Lies, C.S. Fisher et al.'s Inequality by Design, M.K. Brown et al.'s Whitewashing Race, and R.E. Nisbet's Intelligence and How to Get It. Invoking an average African-American IQ score that is 15 points lower than that of whites errs in its assumption that the difference is innate. We've seen such assumptions of genetic mediation invoked before, as Stephen Jay Gould reminds us. Before World War II, the shorter stature of the average Japanese national was assumed to be a racial, genetically transmitted trait. But after westernization and economic prosperity led to an enriched diet, the average height of the Japanese increased dramatically and far too quickly to be ascribed to genetics. Not only are the hereditarians' claims wrong, their arguments are illogical and reflect naivete about genetics. They often espouse futility and urge the defunding of educational enrichment programs such as Head Start because, they insist, nothing can change genetically lower IQs. But not only has no specific gene been identified that mediates the IQ differences they reference, these enrichment opponents are conveniently forgetting a key fact about genetic disorders and conditions. Genetic does not equal intractable. So genetic conditions are not by definition without remedy. Even biological flaws due to demonstrably genetic causes can be remedied. For example, children born with the genetic disorder phenylketonuria, PKU, suffer profound mental retardation. Unless they are diagnosed in time to withhold phenylalanine from their diet, in which case they suffer no retardation or ill effects at all. So even if IQ were genetically mediated, this would be no reason to abandon efforts to elevate it. Gould also offers the example of nearsightedness, a visual defect that can be inherited and pose a serious bar to achievement if it is severe enough to prevent the affected person from learning, reading, functioning well on the job, and even negotiating the world safely. But eyeglasses and contact lenses erase the disability and close the performance gap between the nearsighted and the normally sighted. Healthy, wealthy, and wise? I submit that in today's communities of color, IQ is largely compromised by disproportionate health assaults like a legion of chemical exposures, nutritional deficiencies and poisons, alcohol, drugs, and pathogens that cripple the nervous system. In IQ and the Wealth of Nations, Lynn and Van Hannon agree that intelligence is causally related to economic and health status. But they argue that high intelligence creates well-being, not the other way around. They also insist that beyond improving nutrition, very little can be done about poor health caused by low intelligence. But as Girma Berhanu wrote in the journal Educational Review, Van Hanen has got his argument backwards. It makes far more sense to argue that the populations of rich countries do better on IQ tests because they have access to better nutrition and education. In 2006, evolutionary psychologist Satoshi Kanazawa pushed the theory of reverse causation further by theorizing that the low intelligence among people of color in the developing world has created their poor health status. In Mind the Gap, In Intelligence, Reexamining the Relationship Between Inequality and Health, published in the British Journal of Health Psychology, he posited that distance from the African birthplace of man directly correlates to both IQ and to health status. The farther away a nation is from sub-Saharan Africa, both latitudinally and longitudinally, he added a few years later, the higher the average intelligence of the nation's population. According to Kanazawa, a reader in management at the London School of Economics, Africa, and by extension the larger tropical and subtropical world, provide a garden-like environment that was warm and nurturing with abundant food. Familiar and easy to live off, he argues, so that success within it requires very little intellectual effort. But those early men and women who left the continent for the North and West encountered unfamiliar environments, characterized by freezing winters and seasonally disappearing food. Environments that Kanazawa says were far more difficult to survive. Evolutionary pressures selected for those clever enough to adapt, so these people became healthier, smarter Westerners, including scholars who now congratulate themselves on having picked the right forebears. But experts point out that Kanazawa's basic assumption is erroneous. Africa is no benign Garden of Eden with fruit hanging from every tree. Africans had to contend with apex predators, poisonous plants and animals, drought, oppressive rainy seasons, unfriendly neighbors, and, in the southern and elevated parts of the continent, with snow and cold, just as in Europe. Not to mention a prodigious variety of infectious diseases. University of New Mexico evolutionary biology professor Randy Thornhill responded, "To say just generally that these new environments were more difficult is open to criticism, I think. Because the tropical environment is terribly difficult, especially the diseases. People describe how they work in the tropics, and they're just covered in parasites. It's like parasite rain. We need only reflect that the diseases of West Africa killed so many 19th century European soldiers that it earned the sobriquet White Man's Grave." Epic also disagrees with Kanazawa's insistence that the high disease rate in Africa, much of it infectious disease, can be caused by low human intelligence. "We know that the distribution of infectious disease is largely not determined by humans. It's determined by the diseases and the types of environments that they thrive in. No one's ever caught a case of malaria in Alaska because the mosquitoes that carry it can't survive in Alaska. That is entirely independent of human intervention." Kanazawa's evolutionary biologist peers found his analysis sloppy and illogical. In spite of his unsupported claims, Kanazawa's racialized blame-the-victim approach to health harms is a strategy that industry has found useful in sidestepping responsibility for poisoning communities. It recurs often in these pages.
Repeat offenders, that's what they call it, recidivism. I think they got a lot of fancy terms that they use for locking up black people for that. But that's the sort of thing where I say, hey, this is not happenstance. This is dedication to racism, white supremacy, and they're committed to it. They're not going to change. Reading this book, reading Medical Apartheid, just chronicles what they already know and are doing deliberately. The Cows just finished our second audio segment. A Terrible Thing to Waste, Harriet A. Washington. If you have comments, questions to share, number to dial 605 313-5164, the code 564-943, pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. All of the folks who were with us first time around should be here. Henry in Chicago, Ivy, if she's feeling well, Thomas in New York, retired firefighter. If you have a comment, question you would like to share, and particularly if you did not get to speak at all after the first audio segment, get your hand up now. Do not wait until the last 5 minutes and decide that you have a question or comment about something Miss Washington wrote. Go ahead and get a hand up. Press star 61 and we'll get you on the line early. Make sure you get your thoughts, questions on the air. All of the folks who have a hand up, line should be open. If you have thoughts, questions on what's been shared, proceed. Retired firefighter, there's a little bit of static coming through on your line. I heard it before. I don't know if that's what Thomas was hearing in terms of the disruption, but I can hear it. I just muted your line and now it's gone. I'm not sure what that is. If you want to hang up and dial us back and see if maybe that clears the line, but there is a little bit of distortion on your line, retired firefighter. I'll open your line up as soon as you if you want to hang up and dial back in, I'll open your line right back up as soon as you dial in. Let's see. The other folks who are with us, did you all have comments, questions?
Ivy here.
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Ivy. I was able to follow the second portion on the audio part. However, like I was able to follow most of it, and I was listening to how, you know, the narrator was talking about, and basically, you know, the author was talking about all the IQ stuff that the race soldiers use to practice terrorism. The thing that I didn't understand and that I didn't catch, and I'm sure it was probably even in the first portion because you were talking about it, which is, why she is talking about that? Like, what does that have to do with environmental racism? Like, is she saying that these IQ tests and all this stuff is the stuff that they're using to justify practicing environmental racism? Or, you know, so why? And then the other thing I wanted to know is that at the end of the broadcast tonight, can I ask a question about where to find another broadcast? Because for that particular broadcast that I'm thinking about, the link is broken on Black Talk Radio. And so, yeah, I'm in my mind.
Sure, we can get that question in before we get off the air. Just give me a reminder. The first question in terms of why is Harriet A. Washington, why is she spending so much time at the beginning of this book that's supposed to be about environmental racism, why is she spending so much time on intelligence tests and white people's use of them and what they're supposed to signify? I haven't read this book before, being transparent, as they say. My understanding, at least the way that she has laid things out, I think you're correct. The long history of white people, that's how she started, the long history of white people insisting that black people are stupid, and that's justification for all sorts of racism, environmental racism and everything else, slavery, whatever it's going to be. I think her premise is that, number one, this history exists. It's lots of lies, and it has continued in many, many varieties to this day, with this belief that black people are less intelligent than white people. I think that is important because I think she wants to set out that this can be changed. There are things that can be done, as she mentioned with iodine. There are things that you can do. I think she just said, as the portion we just concluded with, glasses, if you are nearsighted, getting glasses, correcting a vision problem. There are things that can be done to change intelligence. So even if you do believe that black people are inferior intellectually, there are things that can be done so that that doesn't have to be permanent. And I think the pivot to environmental racism, what I was not thinking before, there are things that white people, racists, do deliberately to the environment that contribute to black people having lower IQ scores, lower intelligence, bring damaging poisonous materials that they inject in the environment that contribute to this. If we stop doing this, that alone could reduce some of what they call this disparity in intelligence or IQ between black people. I think that's the reason she, because she hasn't even really got into detail about the ways that environmental racism damages the brains of black people, although she's hinted at that quite a bit already. So I think that's the way that she's setting this up. I could be wrong, but we'll have to see. We're still pretty early in the book. Yeah, it's got to be it, because that's the chapter that we're in now, Color-Coded Intelligence, right? That's the first part of the book, the chapter, The Prism of Race, How Politics Shrouds the Truth About Our Nation's IQ. So getting at a lot of the Dr. Shockley and the bell curve racism, white supremacy around intelligence, and then getting to how environmental racism minimizes, detracts from the intelligence, intellect of black people. That's the second part. So I think that's the roadmap for the book.
Okay, thank you for that.
For sure, for sure. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed. Maybe folks are getting their notes together. I will go through a few of my notes from the second portion of the reading and then check in again. This, again, I think would be a good book to get your hands on. It shouldn't be difficult. Like, I didn't have a lot of trouble getting this book. I am in Seattle, but I didn't have a lot of trouble getting this book. It's pretty new, and she's a pretty well-known, established author, so I suspect they would have this book at many, many libraries where you could probably borrow a copy or hard copy, paperback, whatever it is. It seems like it's pretty readily available, so should be easy, and it'd probably be a good one. Probably be a good one to have on the library, just based on what we've read thus far, but we'll see. We're still pretty early. So what I highlighted from the second portion, let's see. I thought that was important when she talked about the IQ tests. They're supposed to be used to compare individuals from a similar background, and then they're using these IQ tests to compare people who have grown up in different parts of the universe and have had different circumstances. I thought that was an important point. Brain damaging. That's why I said I think she's laying out the history of white culture and racism, and insisting that black people are stupid to justify racism, and then going to the how environmental racism robs black people of their intelligence and high-level brain functioning. So she says, brain-damaging chemicals, as do members... Wait a minute, make sure I get the full... Bam, full sentence. The denizens of low-IQ nations have a lot in common with residents of lower-IQ ethnic enclaves of the United States. They suffer exposure to the same sort of brain-damaging chemicals as do members of U.S. racial minority groups, and with the same potent but underappreciated effect on their cognition and intelligence as is apparent in their depressed IQ scores. That's it. Right there. I think that's it exactly. Boom. Lay down the nonsense of white racism first, and then get to environmental racism does a whole lot to damage the brains of black and non-white people worldwide. Let's see. Again, I thought she had a lot of great information just about how these IQ scores and rankings are used to denigrate dark people. Even when she said that some of these tests, it shows Asians, not Europeans, occupying the highest spot, so that these rankings serve to denigrate dark people, black people, again, black get back. Let's see. She said, yet racist can be unhelpful, can be an unhelpful assessment. Surveys show that various groups define the term quite differently, so it often impedes rather than clarifies communication. That's why we start our programs here what's our definition for racism, and we make sure that it's accurate so that we understand what we mean, as opposed to just everybody throwing out a term and acting like we all know what each other mean, or acting like we all mean the same thing when that's not the case at all. And talk about brain damage. One of the ways that white people pollute the environment is by using terms incorrectly, particularly racism, using it incorrectly or using it without a definition or using it with an incorrect definition. That contributes mightily to that right there. People using that, that we don't have clear communication when using the term racism. Another part of environmental racism by whites. Let's see. Next, she said, whatever potential a given fetus has, exposures and deprivation can ensure that his or her future IQ will be lower than average, sometimes devastatingly so. Whether a child in utero is exposed to alcohol during a key moment of development, is that chemical and biological warfare if white people deliberately saturate black areas with alcohol? You don't get Whole Foods. You don't get yoga studios. You get a liquor store. Is that chemical and biological warfare? Continuing. I lost my place in the paragraph. Oh, uterus exposed to alcohol during key moment of development, assaulted by PCBs, arsenic or mercury, or assailed by a pathogen associated with a loss of cognition or memory, it is the brain's experience, not genetics, that will dictate the child's intelligence and IQ. IQ is not impervious to change. We have been watching average IQs change within populations for decades in the West, as well as in some of those irredeemably low IQ nations. And then she talks about the boost in IQ in the country of Kenya, so-called. And they talked about a lot of it was improvement in health. What I just said, you know, even if you have foot pain, that's about as far from your brain as you can get on your anatomical body. If your foot hurts bad enough, at some point, you are not going to want to listen to Gus T. Renegade. You are not going to want to read Harriet A. Washington. You're not. Only thing you're going to think about is, man, my foot hurts. I hope it was something we could do about my foot. That Gus T. gets on my nerves, but if he could do something about my foot, I'll listen. Other than that, I don't want to hear him or anybody else because my foot hurts. You're not going to be able to think very well. You're probably not going to be able to remember things very well because you'll be focused on your foot. You get that foot taken care of, oh man, your creativity comes back. The imagination comes back. You can think and do a whole lot of things. That would happen for lots of black people, I suspect. And again, the importance that intelligence can change. It can be improved. It can be decimated. If we poison you, drop all these toxins on you, you probably won't be thinking very well either and might even be confused about what's happening as to why you are not thinking well. You get to that victim blaming again. Let's see. Oh, did somebody make sure I'm not missing folks? Did I hear someone have comments they wanted to get in? Just hearing things. Right on. Necessary bias. Now, that's important subtitle. Necessary bias, in my view, it would just be commitment to white supremacy racism. It says, she writes, why do some cling to notions that a racial difference in IQ means an innate, unchanging difference in African American intellectual potential? In my view, again, dedication to white supremacy necessary. This is exactly the word she used, necessary. This is necessary in order to maintain a system of white supremacy. We have to insist that black people are ignorant and stupid, and then we go about means to make sure that they remain ignorant and stupid. We don't want them reading. They don't have libraries with no fees just everywhere. They got that in Seattle now. They don't have that just where you got a whole lot of black people. You can just go to the library willy-nilly and check out books anytime you want to and don't have to pay a fee or anything. Bring them back when you want. Oh, no. We don't want to have spectacular education. Azure Savage wrote about that. We don't want spectacular education for black children. You're not supposed to be in the gifted classes anyway. Maybe if you have a white parent to fight for you, but even then, That is dedication. That is necessary. And again, it's white people are not ignorant. They don't need to read a book like this to grasp, like, oh man, we've been doing this. Maybe we should stop insisting that little colored folks are ignorant so that we'll stop mistreating them. That's not what this is about. They are dedicated to that mistreatment. Let's see. Man, when she said, still learning, she said French scientist Louis Pierre Gratelet, I'm a victim, still learning, added that in the Negro, the cranium closes on the brain like a prison. It is no longer a temple divine, to use the expression of Malpighi, but a sort of helmet for resisting heavy blows. That's all a direct quote. Talk about hard-headed. The coon skull, it's not for thinking. It's not for keeping your brain safe. It's just a little helmet, so you can use him to use his head to crack through walnuts and break concrete walls. Beat on him a little bit. That's all his head is good for. Just put his head down. You just can't injure the Negro. That unbreakable skull he's got. Good for a beating. They say that a lot, too. That is another major pattern, that black people are ignorant and black people are good for a beating. They can withstand a beating. You can just beat on them and beat on them and beat on them. They can take some punishment. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure? Get in. Dubois, I thought that was a great quote that she included from W.E.B. Du Bois when they had this test of whites against blacks in Louisiana and Mississippi, where they have kept them ignorant and fought tooth and nail to keep them ignorant, and said the Negro, this is Du Bois' word she's quoting, she said, the Negro is equal to that of a 9-year-old white boy, and that we should arrange our educational program to make waiters, porters, scavengers, and the like of most Negroes. I read that and I said, wow, that W.E.B. Du Bois, number one, great quote. And until I said, wait a minute, if the Negro is equal to a 9-year-old white boy, which Mr. Fuller has said, hey, white children are not ignorant about racism. But how do you prepare someone to be a scavenger? What does that education, I mean, we got Edgar. He's in the remedial class, right? He's going to be trained. He's ignorant. He's illiterate. Stupid as can be. Biggest dunce in the world. We're going to train you to be a scavenger. What? What does that look like? Train you to be a scavenger. We're going to go out today, and we've buried a few objects in the mud. We'll give you good hour or so to find everything. We'll come back and check on you. Is that what? Woo! When you play around with sex, you don't factor in your child's academic program for the next 15 years before you get to the bedroom. Your child might be trained to be a scavenger. Anybody have comments they wanted to get in before we wrap things up?
Yes. I always had questions when it came to IQ tests and the sort of, you know, that is so-called proving that black people are not, or non-white people are not smart enough or anything like that. Who are the racists convincing on that subject? White people or non-white people? That's the question. By imposing all of these tests and come up with the same, basically the same analysis. Who are they convincing?
It would be some of both. Let's see, we have about 7 minutes left. I'll just say quickly, probably some of both. I think the system works easier if you have a lot of victims who believe that, yes, white people are more intelligent. You have more non-white people on the planet than white people. So I would certainly think that a good portion of that, if we can get them to believe that they are inferior, it will make our job much, much easier. Let's see. Irie, did you have commentary you wanted to get in?
Yeah. So I don't have the same experience as a full-time teacher, but I do substitute frequently. And when I go in the classroom, a lot of times I can tell the children that are suffering from so-called intellectual or emotional disorders a lot of times from either malnutrition or malnutrition from not eating enough or not eating things that are poisonous. I don't know how many times, I can't count the times that children have come into my classroom with hot fries Takis, Cheetos, Doritos, so forth and so on, Hershey's, donuts and donut holes. And then to top it, they're pulverizing their brain with these blue lights at night with the tablets that are purposefully issued to them by the school to not only monitor them because there's cameras on these devices, but also to bombard them with blue light at night. And a lot of the times the children don't have adequate sleep along with bad food or no food at all. So they can't sit, they can't concentrate, and then, you know, they can't read if they can read. And if they are illiterate to top it, then you can already imagine what that's like. The fact that that person mentioned that our skulls become prisons to, you know, basically like a helmet, that's what the cranium is supposed to do. But when you're a white supremacist, you twist words to make something that is good and normal, you make it sound abnormal in a non-white person. I'd like to know the white person that doesn't have a cranium to protect their brain. Everyone does. And the last thing I want to say, one thing I learned from a communications class I took years ago, so-called intelligence measurements start with frame of reference. So if you don't have a frame of reference, you're in a certain part of the world that doesn't know what a kettle is, but you know what a drinking gourd is, but you take a test willingly to try to identify what a kettle is, you're not going to know if you don't have that exposure or frame of reference. So this is just white people's dependency on diminishing and lying, just straight lying on the intelligences of non-white people. Because without it, they don't have, it won't work. And yes, black people have to buy in. I don't know how many times I've heard black people say, oh, well, she's slow, or her mama got a check, so she gets one, she gonna get one too. These lowered expectations from the start for non-white kids. And I'll end my turn for the night. Thank you.
Much obliged, Irie. Thomas in New York, did you have anything you wanted to add, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Gus, for opening my eye. What was the name of that first chapter what was just read, that last part?
Uh-oh. The name? Do you want the name of the first chapter, or?
Yeah, that was what she was reading. She was in the first chapter, right?
Yes, we're still in the chapter one. The first chapter, so part one is called Color-Coded Intelligence. That's a question. And then chapter one is titled The Prism of Race, How Politics Shroud the Truth About Our Nation's IQ. That's chapter one.
Wow. I mean, in my opinion, she could have named that the operational logic of a system of white supremacy. I mean, it was, to me, excellent. She laid it all out perfectly. It's all eugenics. It's all built on the out of Africa theory, which they have yet to prove. All sciences and philosophies whites have used and teach are based off of that logic. As people left Africa, they got lighter and they further evolved. Alfred Binet, inventor of the IQ test and scores, all part of eugenics. He was a craniologist trying to prove the outer Africa theory by measuring people's heads, trying to say that the European is superior and justified to be in charge because they have more superior mental capacity. And he's the person who invented the IQ test. Like, geniuses. when you look at who makes the test, you know, how can you take this serious? How can you give people in a third world country the same test you give people in Britain and the United States and France? Like, it's such a racist concept. It's like one of the most racist concepts you could ever think of. And all these IQ tests, I remember in school, they used to call it the California Achievement Test, the CAT. And my mother was a public school teacher. We didn't take that in Catholic school. But, you know, she would be under so much pressure to try to get these kids to score good on this CAT and, you know, trying to cram them with all this information. And every year they would say, oh, your school is failing. And, you know, we have to send the state in to take over and implement all these programs and that never worked and just play toss back to the city from the state with the school based off of these tests. And they're all IQ tests, you know, and this is what they build the prison, industrial complex. Everything is built off of this whole system right here. So I'm glad that she laid that out in this chapter. Even down to the outer alphabet theory, I mean, that's the whole thing whites use. I mean, once you take them out of there, they don't got nowhere to be. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged. She did talk about that a whole lot of things happened right there with Edgar that she mentioned, a little black child that getting stuffed into those remedial classes. A whole lot talk about brain damage. A whole lot can start right there with you not being developed and school to prison pipeline. Then we get to do some more experiments on you. And then, oh, yeah, the nigger is just ignorant. Knew he was going to end up there. Little colored folks, they just don't read. They're just as ignorant as can be. That's what they're going to be, a scavenger. Get you in prison so you can be a scavenger, and we'll pay you a cent to go out on the highway and scavenge. We will wrap there. We did our 3 hours. We'll pick up next week. We're still in Chapter 1, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Harriet A. Washington, the Great. If you haven't read Medical Apartheid, ooh-wee, get to it. We'll be here tomorrow, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and then we'll be here Saturday as well. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Dial in if you have questions, thoughts. We should be on this book, I think, until close to spring. It's not very long, but it should take us, you know, 8 weeks or so to get through, so should be close to springtime by then. Anyway, 24 hours we'll be here for Workplace Racism. Much obliged for everyone's participation this evening. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I so highly appreciate her mentioning alcohol as being one of these brain-damaging substances. Amen. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, chemical and biological warfare. Think of that every time you see that liquor store on the corner. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, just trying to do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being sober and buckled up, every time you're in a vehicle, if you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. As I said, just trying to minimize contact with the Amber Geigers, Daniel Holtzclaws of the known universe, trying to be as safe as we can under conditions designed to be dangerous, toxic, brain damaging. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.